and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I could drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here today on the big program. Dave Jamieson, Huffington Post workplace reporter, going to be here talking about the Foxconn situation, Apple's productions. You know, this is one of those things that you know is going to get covered up. They're going to throw a couple of pennies to the people. They're going to hush-hush. They're going to harass, intimidate, so it looks like, oh, something's been done. We're actually helping those workers. And American consumers are going to go, see, so they're trying, so we can keep buying the overpriced Apple products, and we can keep buying all of these foreign-made electronics. Instead of saying, hey, why aren't you consuming this stuff yourself? How about we build our own stuff, we consume our own stuff, instead of making that the manufacturing mecca of the globe? And a model based on exploitable, cheap, not only labor, but also pollution and environmental destruction, which is what the Republicans keep telling us we need to do here. More business friendly. So it'll be good to talk to Dave Jamieson about that. In the second hour, Dave Waldman, contributing editor over at dailycos.com, going to be here talking about the Heartland Institute. Last week we talked about the release of documents, basically just solidifying what we already know. We know that the billionaire class is funding these euphemistically named think tanks and, well, not really think tanks, but propaganda tanks. So the more money they get, and it's not even a lot of money, which is really what's surprising about these Heartland Institute documents. It's not an awful lot of money, and it just shows how cheap some of these academics, how cheap it is to buy some of them off. But we'll talk about that. Also in the second hour, Steve Bertelli, International Vice President for Region 3 of the Bakery and Confectionery Workers, going to be here talking about the Journey for Justice March. Tomorrow, I guess, that's going to start in Fargo, North Dakota, as the workers from American Crystal Sugar and the workers from Cooper Tire in Findlay march from Fargo to Findlay, Ohio, to highlight the plight of locked-out workers. You know, we used to hear a lot about strikes. Oh, those workers are discontent. They're not happy, and they're striking, and, oh, that's a bad thing, and we need to stop that, which is the whole reason that Taft-Hartley and all that stuff, because workers were actually saying, we've got rights? Yes, we do, and we're going to fight for them. Now the tables have turned. The pendulum has swung so far to the business-friendly side that how dare a worker say, I'm not taking a 50% pay cut, or how dare you say you're not working in dangerous conditions? Look at those workers in China. So if you're not going to do it, we're not going to let you. We're going to kick you to the curb, and we're going to replace you, which is why I go back to why I voted for Bill Clinton the first time. I voted for him because he said he was going to put a strike replacement bill in. There should not be a third party interjected in that situation. Look, at the end of the day, it's like, to me, the employer-employee relationship is kind of like a marriage. Once you enter into that bond, that you're going to have this relationship, you should work it out. You sit down at the negotiating table, you talk to each other. When you introduce a third party, a scab comes into this, one way or the other. To me, that's a problem. But for business, hey, that's just a way of lowering wages and keeping things down and making sure that we have a pliable working class. So it'll be interesting to talk to Steve about the big march. And in the third hour, Chanel Herring is going to be here. She's a Virginia delegate, much like our state representatives here from the 46th district there in Virginia. She's going to talk about how Virginia has completely lost its mind. This abortion thing in Virginia evidently is now the big news. This state-sponsored rape bill that they've come up with, this transvaginal ultrasound they want to do. A regular ultrasound evidently wasn't enough. They basically, and anybody who's gone through the whole pregnancy thing, you know, they do two types of ultrasound. The one where they put a little jelly on the belly and, you know, they just rub the little thing, oh, you can see this or that. This one, no. They actually want invasion. They want to get in there and not only make you see what's going on, but also the degrading method by which they're going to do it. I mean, it's really quite remarkable how far the radical right is willing to go at tearing women down. I mean, it's just and it's amazing to me that women haven't completely left the GOP. Now we look at Santorum's numbers, numbers going down. The GOP people are waking up to the Santorum GOP. When I see the numbers, women are down supporting him from 42% down to 34%. They've fallen that far, and that's in a week. What's next week going to bring? The more Santorum keeps opening his mouth. Absolutely amazing. Anyway, today we're going to take your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You can also email me during the program, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Great to be back in the studio. Yesterday took a day off, and I want to thank Steve Herzenberg, Dr. Herzenberg, and our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson, for sitting in and giving me a much-needed day to get some family stuff done and get some things that I needed to get caught up on done. So I want to thank them. I hope you enjoyed it. I'd love to hear your thoughts, comments, what you thought of Steve and Irwin yesterday, because I'm hoping they'll come and come back again real soon, because I've got more things that may come up. But the weekend was an interesting weekend for me. Basketball, my producer is thrilled. My 9- and 10-year-old basketball coaching is now done for the season. It was an interesting season. It was a learning experience, I think more for me than for them, because we still didn't really run the play all year long, but, that's probably my fault. And the more I'm around kids and the more you do the coaching thing and the older they get, the more respect that I have for teachers. I mean, absolutely 100%. You know, I had 16 girls for an hour and a half Mondays and Wednesday nights, and then on the weekends we had a game, and that was enough. I can't imagine getting into teaching, getting into the profession, having to deal with 30, 40, and now we're seeing class sizes up to 60 kids in a classroom. In Michigan, the one had 72 kids in a classroom. I don't know how you handle that. And, it's remarkable. And my hat's off to teachers, people who are able to control that situation. I evidently was not capable of doing it effectively. Next year, maybe, if my daughter plays again, much to the chagrin of my producer, I will do it again. Because, the reality is I think like most people, we all as kids played sports. I went through, high school, into college, all that. And I had some really bad coaches. And that's the whole reason that I coach my kids' teams. I don't want them exposed to the insane ones. And for the most part, most of the people who I've met through being involved with it, pretty rational. But this past weekend, I got to talk about this because it's driving me insane. We're talking about 9- and 10-year-old girls. I think a couple of 11-year-olds. It's 4th and 5th graders. And it is what it is. You know the teams that are, they've got the really tall girl. They're going to win. And you kind of know how that goes. Well, the coach of the one team that we were playing over the weekend, I guess they haven't won a game all year. So they merged the two teams they had. They came together and they were actually very competitive. You've lost every game. Why is this last one, the one you decide to go absolutely ballistic over and threaten the official? I mean, it makes really no sense. You're talking about 4th and 5th grade basketball game. This isn't the NBA. This isn't, there's no big check at the end. There are no scouts in the audience. Just dumb. And I look at this guy and I go, this is the reason that I do it. because you've got these people who are, I don't know what, is it reliving, you know, their glory days? I don't know. And it's one of those things that's really kind of bizarre about sports, that you have these coaches who are just insane. And I'm sure you've had your experiences. I know I've had tons of them. But, you know, I looked at this and it was just amazing to me. But this year we actually learned some things, I think. I think for my daughter, what it means to be competitive. And one of the things that bothers me, I think, as a society are what we've done to kids. And I'm not sure how this has gone about. But in a very strange way, we want them to be more competitive. We're doing more standardized tests. We're doing all of this stuff. Yet they seem to be less competitive than when I was a kid. And maybe it's just just my looking at it and, being the old guy in the room. But I remember kids being we competed over everything. And I think at the end of this year, they started getting it. I'm hoping. I'm still hopeful. But anyway, so that was my experience. That was my weekend. I hope everything went well for you. So the big GOP presidential primary back in full swing tomorrow night will probably be the last debate. All indications, this is it, the final debate before the convention, before they get into all of the other stuff that comes along. Because I don't think Romney wants any part of more debates. I don't think he needs it. I think he's got enough money to get out there and do whatever he wants to do to push his message. And like I said last week, you know, Gingrich, he'll debate anywhere. He's a master debater. He'll probably debate all by himself. I'm sure he does that anyway. But, you know, Santorum, he needs it. Santorum needs that exposure. I think this is going to be it. So it'll be interesting to see what happens tomorrow night as they hold the final debate before the next set of primaries, Super Tuesday coming up. They're talking a possibility of a brokered convention. That would be fantastic. I was talking to my Tea Party dentist yesterday. I took my daughter over to get her teeth done and cleaned. And he's like, "Oh, you've got to be thrilled. You know, Santorum being the Republican candidate, you've got to be thrilled at this." And I go, "Yes and no." I go, I mean, it's one thing to have the crazy guy being the ticket, the head of the ticket, but there's a chance that the crazy guy could win. And the crazy guy, if you go back to 1980, you know, everybody looked at Reagan as the crazy guy. Reagan was the radical. He was the outlier. He was the fringe candidate. Everybody, you know, most of the insiders wanted George H.W. Bush, you know, head of the CIA, good credentials, you know, as a congressman, all of that stuff right up, and not radical. Reagan wins it, and the Carter people were happy. And you go, okay, you got a shot at beating him. Then what happened? Well, I mean, you can go back and look at the history of it. Some bad things happened. And the question then becomes is, you know, the Iran situation, did the Reagan people have something to do with that, as some claim? You figure that out for yourself. But could we see something else like that in the coming months that propels a theocrat like Santorum? I sure hope not. I sure hope not. But they sure tell an interesting story. You know, I was listening to some of the discussions this week about this, you know, America's an aspirational country. And they really tell an interesting story of, you know, how we became a prosperous nation. It's heaped in this, well, we had free enterprise. And I kind of differ with most of that. I kind of differ with a good portion of it, especially when they're talking about, you know, how we became a prosperous nation. We became a prosperous nation. Why? Because we had strong labor unions. People joined unions, and you know what? They got a piece of the pie. And I look at what's going on over in China, and I'm hoping that workers are organizing over there, and I'm hoping that we as a people, as a nation, encourage that and help it. And when we come back, we're going to talk with Dave Jamieson from Huffington Post. He's our workplace reporter on this Foxconn situation. And really, you know, the whole scenario is going to go around it. You know, is it going to be a big cover-up? Will it be a whitewash? We'll find out after this. Quick break. Right back after this. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. Monday and shipping it offshore to the job you're living for.
work in America. One show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Warehouse workers are calling on Walmart to address issues with contractors that violate labor laws. On Thursday, workers in Southern California attempted to deliver a petition to one such contractor, Schneider Logistics. The petition calls on the company to rescind a plan to fire 100 workers. Warehouse Workers United secured an injunction from the company to not follow through with the plans on February 24th. The employees had filed suit in 2011, demanding wages they allege had been stolen by the company. They say they were paid less than minimum wage, denied overtime, and weren't paid for lunch breaks. The workers rallied on Thursday to deliver the petition to a local warehouse, and the petition was refused at the door. Nick Allen is with Warehouse Workers United.
What happened here is such an obvious illustration of how this management treats these workers. They will not accept a simple written petition signed by these workers asking for their basic rights. They will not even take it to read it. That is the level of disrespect that these workers experience every day.
The largest restaurant group in Florida has refused to weigh in on an effort to reduce wages for tipped workers in the state. Darden Group, which owns restaurants such as Red Lobster, issued a statement that due to economic conditions, this is not the right time to be having a discussion about cutting wages for servers. The bill would see the minimum wage for tipped workers cut from $4.65 per hour to the federal minimum of $2.13 per hour. However, the proposal does include a guarantee for employees of nearly $10 per hour for tips and wages combined. OSI, a restaurant group that owns businesses such as Outback, has said it supports the measure. During a rally last week led by Unite Here, restaurant employee Erica Feliciano said the move was a step backwards.
Minimum wage is $4-something an hour and we want to cut it by $2. I feel like we're going back, 10 years ago.
Unite Here represents workers at Disney who will be opening 2014 contract negotiations just as the new wage goes into effect if it passes.
Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Demanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show. I got a
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. So Gene sent me an email talking about the Foxconn situation. And, basically saying, look, the inspections are going to be a sham, as I said last week. But he points out this Fair Labor Association. He points out that they found the plant where the iPhones and the iPads are made. Evidently, this Fair Labor Association is saying that far better conditions than those in the garment industry or other facilities in the country. So, it's better than the country. They also said the main quote is the lead investigator said that the facilities are first class. The physical conditions are way, way above average of the norm, which I guess the question then becomes is what is the new norm? What is the acceptable norm? And I got to find out about this Fair Labor Association. I'm not liking it. Anyway, I've got Dave Jamieson on the line. He is a workplace reporter over at Huffington Post. Dave, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, Rick, good to be here.
I look at this Fair Labor Association. Personally, I don't think I've ever heard of them. I'm kind of leery about what they're, given this information, I'm leery what their findings are going to be.
Yeah, I'm kind of myself just sort of learning about them now. It's a nonprofit that's been around maybe 12, 13 years. You know, I think they're some of the big early investigations they did was of Nike factories overseas. And yeah, I think that the concern here is that you know they're somewhat dependent on the corporations that they're tasked with going out and investigating on behalf of. So you know, like when it comes to Apple, if they have a formal relationship with Apple, if there's funding coming in part from Apple, you know, what people are wondering is you know, how thorough an investigation is and, you know, how good can it be when there's a potential conflict of interest there.
Yeah, I go back to a report I saw in January that this Foxconn facility had I guess 150 employees pledged that they would kill themselves if working conditions didn't improve. And you go, well, you know, out of a couple thousand, 100,000, 150, that's not bad. You're talking about 150 people willing to kill themselves.
Yeah, I mean, what most people know, if they know anything of Foxconn, was the now somewhat infamous safety nets that had to be put up. You know, this was after a string of suicides a couple years ago, and so they ended up having to erect these nets in case, you know, to discourage people from jumping off. So the really interesting thing here, and you've alluded to it, you know, as we were coming in here, is, you know, sort of the relativity of all this. You know, people are talking like, you know, if we're going to say that we know there are documented problems at Foxconn. If we're saying it's okay because by relative standards, by norms, it's a little better than other places, then, you know, it raises all these questions of, you know, should there be a difference between what's acceptable over there as opposed to what's acceptable here? Because I think, you know, a lot of what's been documented over there simply wouldn't fly here, but we may ultimately be saying it's okay because, you know, by Chinese standards or by Asian standards, it's not that bad.
Yeah, I mean, and for me, you know, I go back to the right-wing argument that I've heard time and time again. Whenever you talk about exploitation, you talk about horrible working conditions like we're seeing in this and in others. The right-wing argument is, well, you know, the working conditions may be bad, and well, that's, you know, that's just horrible. It's better than it would be if the companies weren't there exploiting them.
Right, and what specifically you hear about China often these days, especially when you're talking about Foxconn and the area around it, which is now obviously a huge manufacturing area, is that, you know, that being poor there is now, you know, marginally or a good deal better than it was being poor rurally, which is where a lot of these folks came from. And it's a very interesting argument. You know, I've heard it coming from different places and even from liberals who, you know, it may make them squirm a little bit to say it, but, you know, the idea is that, you know, poverty and harsh working conditions in these slightly better paying industrial areas is better than being poor out in the country.
Well, that's a great argument if you're an academic or you're someone who sits in an ivory tower somewhere making up models and dreaming up new bad policy. But what about the people that have to compete with them? I mean, right now we're talking about, you hear the presidential candidates talking about we're going to bring manufacturing back. And I always ask the question, you know, under what condition do we have to then be like the Chinese? Since now that seems to be where companies that we look up to, like Apple, seem to want to go.
Right. You know, the administration, you know, with their most recent economic plan is pushing, you know, trying to encourage insourcing, discourage outsourcing through tax policies. And you know, what the president's own economic advisors say is that, you know, they're kind of hanging hopes on some of the rising labor costs in China, that they're hoping that there's going to be some sort of balancing out soon and that jobs are going to come back because of that. And you know, who knows what we'll see on that front. The interesting thing about the Foxconn situation, and this goes a lot with the Amazon controversy last year when we found out some of the very terrible sweatshop-like conditions that were going on in some warehouses. Finally, we're kind of having the veil pulled back on all the crap that we buy here in the U.S., and we're sort of seeing some of the unpleasantness that goes into making these products and getting them here. And so a couple days ago, Foxconn announced that it would be giving its workers there a raise of 20 to 25%, I think it was. And that seems to be a result of the light that's been shined on there, most recently by the New York Times expose a couple weeks ago. And before that, a very fascinating work produced by this guy, Mike Daisy. I don't know if you heard it. He was the guy who went overseas, you know, went to China and talked to workers there. And so we're kind of getting an idea of what it's like for the people who are spending a lot of full days and then some in these factories producing the stuff that we can't get enough of. And you know, if wages are going to go up over there, if conditions are going to improve, that would require us probably paying a little more. And everybody, you know, we like to get outraged over here, and there are online petitions going right now about improving conditions at Foxconn. But I'm sure a lot of those petitions are being signed by people on MacBooks. We get outraged about conditions when we hear about them. But I think, you know, when we're putting our money down as consumers, we want the lowest price possible.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I mean, I look at the iPhone that I have, and I admit it, I've got an iPhone. The phone was $500. You're going to tell me that by raising a couple of pennies so that people can have a decent life over there and maybe hiring another shift, that's going to raise the $550 or $6 or $1,000? I don't see how that's possible when you're looking at the amount of profit that they're making out of this.
Right. No, I think a lot of conscientious consumers would be willing to pay a little more, and it probably would be marginal. I know you would be.
Yeah, absolutely.
But that's not where you're going to hear from the companies, no matter who they are. Yeah.
And the problem, Dave, is there are no, like this iPhone, what's the difference if I buy an iPhone or an Android or one of the other ones? They're all made in similar conditions. That's my problem. There's
right.
No choice, really.
I think something like 40% of all the gadgets that we have now, no matter who's making them, are coming out of that region now.
And it's getting worse because that's where the suppliers are. That's where all the supply lines are. So everybody's, you know, I just saw a story, Nokia is moving from their home country and closing plants in Mexico and other places to head over there.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the same scenario. I want to go back to something you said there a second ago that you said we've now found out. And my thing is I just don't buy that we're just now finding out. I mean, to me, it's something I think we've always known. We just have shielded ourselves from and closed our eyes or turned our backs on because, hey, we're getting cheap stuff from Walmart or the big boxes. We get a whole cart full of cheap stuff for pennies. Well, who do you think made those things?
Right. No, you're absolutely right. I think in the back of all our minds, we understand that. We just now, I do think it's kind of reaching a higher pitch now, and we're seeing a lot more of it discussed in the media, which is definitely healthy. As you and I have talked on here before about the warehouse industry in this country, and that's another thing. This isn't just workers in China, you know, getting all that stuff here. There are all these unseen jobs throughout the U.S. Those things have to get into our stores. Or they got to get here, you know, into our mailboxes if we're going on, you know, buying stuff on Amazon and other sellers online. And so, you know, we are, as everyone says, this huge consumer economy, and we're kind of strangely seeing less and less of the supply chain, especially as we shop more and more online. And so, you know, I think it's important for people to understand that. There are a lot of very difficult and often very low-paying jobs, not just in China, but in the U.S. that need to be there for us to get our super, super cheap products with our free super saver shipping.
Yeah, and the thing is, you know, as I tell people, you know, by buying something made here, the job you may be saving may be your own. Because that whole supply chain, once you lose that, and I go back to the auto industry, you know, I grew up in Cleveland where there were two major auto plants there. And there were hundreds, if not 1,000, small little shops that fed into those two behemoths. Those are all gone now. And it's what's happening to us as a nation. We have become the consumer of last resort instead of the producer that we used to be. And, you know, while the credit card's, you know, empty, you could be the consumer of last resort. But we're having problems. So let me ask you the last question I've got for you. This concern about what's going on over at Foxconn and a lot of the conditions in China. Do you think it has more to do with the job crisis here at home, where we're saying we should be bringing those jobs? Those are jobs that should have been here. I mean, I look at the cell phone, the stuff that Apple makes. They say 235,000 workers, about the size of Orlando, Florida, make this one product. Isn't that something we should have made here since it was kind of developed here?
Yeah, it sure would be nice. I think it was the Times that had reported on a meeting where Steve Jobs and President Obama were in the room, and Obama had asked something to the effect of what would it take for you to be making iPhones here in the U.S., and Jobs said it simply would never happen. What he was saying, I believe, was that just basically what it sounded like was the efficiency and the speed that they could expect out of a Chinese factory is something that in the U.S. We can no longer do. And I think the subtext of that, it probably has a lot to do with the working conditions.
Yeah, I mean, when they said they can raise up, 8,000 people out of a deep sleep, give them some tea and a biscuit, and get them to work in an hour and a half because they all live right on their life is that factory.
Exactly.
And they're right. I don't think American workers would put up with it. And therefore, I say we shouldn't be buying products from people who do that unless you want to emulate those conditions.
Yeah, you have to go searching far and wide for those products, I guess, these days.
Yeah, good point. Dave Javison, I appreciate the time. Workplace reporter over at Huffington Post. We've got a link to his work over at therickssmithshow.com. Dave, always great talking with you.
Rick, great talking with you.
Thanks so much. Let's take a quick break. Your thoughts after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
If an apple a day keeps the doctor away, will Apple Inc.'s public image get healthier now that it has hired an organization to monitor labor abuses in the foreign factories that make its products? Practically all of the 70 million iPhones and 30 million iPads that the computer giant sold last year were produced in Chinese factories that don't exactly shine with good working conditions. One of the largest, for example, was recently exposed for 72-hour work weeks, forced overtime, child labor, chemical poisonings, deadly explosions, and other rottenness. However, after years of refusing to allow any independent scrutiny of such facilities, Apple honchos have now thrown open the doors of its foreign suppliers, loudly announcing that an outside group called the Fair Labor Association would be free to inspect their Chinese factories. Bravo, right? Apple CEO Tim Cook positively glowed with self-satisfaction, declaring that workers everywhere had the right to safe and fair workplaces. And now he pledged FLA would be able, quote, to independently assess his company's performance. Independently? Not so fast, bucko. It turns out that FLA is notorious among anti-sweatshop groups for its coziness with corporate interests. How cozy? It is largely funded by its corporate members, the very firms being inspected. Indeed, in January, Apple became a corporate member of FLA just in time to go public with its new pledge of openness. Scott Nova is head of the Worker Rights Consortium, a legitimate anti-sweatshop group. As he dryly observed about the FLA Apple deal, independent monitoring means you're generally independent of the companies. This is Jim Hightower saying, to find out if FLA does an honest assessment or just polishes the apple, go to workerrights.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Time for change. Time to rearrange. Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show. You can't tell me. We're gonna make it somehow. I heard a wise man say, revolution starts now.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, Rick at thericksmithshow.com, or you can give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So, today, back in 1972, that's the day that Richard Nixon took the first step, and history.com is saying dramatic first step towards normalizing relations with communist China, the People's Republic of China. Today he ended up in Beijing for a week of talks. Now understand, you know, at the time, you know, the whole idea was to try and use the Chinese against the Soviets, or trying to split the communists up, which, you know, to a degree worked, but also by opening up some trade lines, some talks on how we're going to do that. The thought at the time was to be able to hopefully use China, you know, to stop the war in Vietnam, because, you know, China had given support to the North Vietnamese. So at the time, that was kind of the thought, but it was more about dividing, putting that wedge between the Soviet and the Chinese. And for me, I've been saying all along that opened the door to where we are today. This idea that, and I do believe that the business community, I do believe the business bosses, the corporate bosses, I believe that they envision that being their manufacturing mecca. And I believe that, you know, this whole idea, well, we were going to try and stop the war, I kind of buy. But I also buy, hey, there's an opportunity to exploit over there. And, oh, if we could just open those markets. Because nothing says capitalism like toilet paper. Because you remember, I remember when I was a kid. Did you ever remember that? Well, the Russians, they stand in line for a day to get a roll of toilet paper. I remember that as a kid. I've yet to find many people there who actually did that, though. One of those things. Anyway, you know, going back to Gene's email about this Fair Labor Association, who, you know, I gotta find more out about. We're gonna get some other people to talk about it. Their lead investigator said, you know, the facilities at this place are state of the art, first class. The physical conditions are way above the norm, way above the norm. So the question is, you know, like I said before, what is the new norm? What is going to be the new normal? Because we're talking about bringing manufacturing back. We're talking about, oh, we need to encourage people to produce things here again. And I go, well, under what conditions? And the question I keep asking myself is, as a nation, is our workforce pliable enough to put up with conditions like the Chinese? Now, understand, those were the conditions we had here in the U.S. for years. You know, back in the 90s, the 1890s. And I remember, you know, I remember reading old contracts. You know, I was a Teamster for years, and the National Master Freight Agreement actually had language. They actually had to negotiate language for bunkhouses. And what happened is drivers would go into these terminals, and they would park their truck, and they would go sleep in a cot in a little bunkhouse. And they actually had rules on how the bunks had to be and the whole nine yards. So that they could just go in and wake you up. Hey, it's time for you to leave. Go ahead. That's where they want to take us back to. Now, we fought that and got rid of that. So they had to put you in a hotel and you'd have time to yourself and all of that. But that's where we started. We started back where the Chinese are now. And I keep asking the question, why do we have to allow them to be exploited? Why do we have to keep pushing them to have to do it on their own? Because I guess we had to do it, so they have to do it themselves. When we know it's pulling all of us down. So when those jobs come back, what's it going to mean? Is it going to mean that they're we're exploitable like they are? Have conditions in this country fallen that far? And I look at Mitt Romney, who's running around saying, well, you know, unions play an important role in our society. They do. Yeah, oh, yeah. The unions are good, but it's those union bosses. They're bad. And I keep going and go, union bosses? You mean those people who are elected by their members? Members themselves? You mean those people? And you'd never get an answer out of them that are just union bosses. There's like a caricature that they've made. But I've yet to find. I've yet to find the, you know, the short, fat guy with the big stogie, bald, you know, with little pudgy fingers that he points at you. I've yet to find him. But they keep throwing it out there, and they're masters at it. I mean, they're excellent at pushing their vision of what this country was. And they keep throwing out this, and you're going to hear this a lot, I think. I think the new Republican phrase is, oh, we're an aspirational country. We're an optimistic nation. We're looking at the good. And they do. They tell a very interesting story. And I heard Santorum this weekend talking about World War II. And it was just the most wonderful, it was a great speech to fire up the insaniacs. Because according to him, we stayed out of World War II because we were too much of an optimistic nation. We were too aspirational. And the idea that somehow we thought that Hitler would be an okay guy and the rest of them would be okay, is his view on this. Now, anybody who knows the reason we didn't get into it is because the cons didn't want to get us into it because they were making too much money off of it. In fact, Bush's grandfather, Prescott, made boatloads of money off of what was going on over there. We were selling weapons to everybody, including the Nazis. That's not me trying to be inflammatory. That's reality. And that's the whole reason we stayed out of it. Not some, oh, we were so optimistic. The reality in this country, folks, is we'd better come to our senses. We better do it quickly. Because all we keep being thrown is lies, deception, half-truth, just completely made-up stuff. I mean, I listen to Santorum and I go, did he think this through? Or is he just throwing it out? Whatever comes to his mind, he spews out. Which is why, like I said, women, I think women are finally going, wait a second, he's nuts. The sweater vest was kind of grandfatherly for a little while. Now the sweater vest is insane. Which is why in a week you saw support from women drop from 42 down to 34%. That is a massive drop. And Republicans, keep talking the talk. Keep going after transvaginal ultrasounds. Yes, keep doing that. Keep going after contraception, even though it is a gone. It is done. Contraception's been decided. Keep doing that, because you're finally going to alienate all the women. And part of me thinks, I look at the right, and I look at most of these guys who would support someone like Santorum. They're people I don't think like women very much anyway. They're just control freaks. So I say we better come to our senses. We're still talking about these insane issues that really, what have they done other than destroy us as a nation? Oh, it's a culture war, Rick. Don't you know? I got an email today from a listener, and talking about China, and said that in China there, 100,000 or 100 million Christians. Out of 1.3 or 1.6 billion. So there's this Christian population. Now, we need the Chinese to be more tolerant. And I said, yeah, I'm right there with you. But then I turned it around and I sent it back. And I said, here's the reality. You keep saying that this is a Christian nation and that Muslims don't belong. And this has been an ongoing discussion I've had with this person. And don't you think we should be more tolerant, much like you're saying about Christians and China? I think we, as a globe, we should be more tolerant of other ideas and stop killing each other. That might be a start. Probably not going to happen, but it's a start. And the response I got back was just really kind of twisted. And it's one of those moments where you go, as a nation, we had better expel the insaniacs. We had better get rid of the people, the bomb throwers like Santorum. And I'm not talking about taking them out and shooting them. I'm just talking them, getting them out of our politics. How he's in this is beyond me. How he is someone that people look up to, absolutely beyond me. And part of me says it has to do with our media culture, has to do with, the horse race that was and how much money has been thrown into this. It's just remarkable to me. And, you go back to this China thing. I fully expect FLA, the Fair Labor Association, to come back with a glowing, oh, it's a wonderful thing. And, evidently they're going to sit down, they're going to question some 35,000 workers in groups of about 30 at a time. So that's going to go over really well to get their answers, simple questions, how they were hired, if they paid a fee, whether they had to sign a contract, the conditions of their dorm room, stuff like that. And I'm sitting here, I'm going, this, okay, you're going to release the report in March. We're going to rush that through. You're going to do 35,000 people in groups of 30. I wonder if the boss is going to be sitting there. Will the company representative be there to, you know, to say it for him? And the other part of this is, and understand, the right is seizing on the fact that we've lost manufacturing, even though they're the main culprit. They're one of the main reasons it happened. Go back to Reagan with his high dollar policy that basically forced companies overseas. And gave them tax breaks. Don't forget that. But this, you're going to keep hearing it. We have these high cost regulations. These high cost regulations. That's, you know, that's just killing the country. Nonsense. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Corporations and billions of welfare, while millions in this country don't have a dime to spare. Corporations and billions of welfare, while millions in this country don't have a dime to spare. Millions in this country don't have a dime to spare. Most have billions in this country and not a dime to spare.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Considering Earth as a whole, the year 2011 had the highest economic losses due to earthquakes on record. It also had the highest economic losses due to natural disasters overall on record.
The earthquake analysis released in early 2012 came from the Center for Disaster Management and Risk Reduction in Germany. According to their report, earthquakes and their consequences, such as tsunamis and landslides, caused damages of $365 billion. Over half of that was from the earthquake on March 11th of 2011 and the resulting tsunami in Japan.
The report said that the two countries hardest hit by earthquakes were New Zealand, with a large earthquake near Christchurch in February 2011, and Japan. The Insurance Information Institute in the U.S. and the global reinsurance firm Munich Re in Germany both issued reports calling the Japan earthquake the most costly natural disaster of any kind in history.
Globally, the Institute said, 2011 was the costliest year ever for natural disasters, and the earthquake and tsunami in Japan were a big part of that. They accounted for more than half of the total damage from natural disasters worldwide. I'm Jorge Salazar.
And I'm Deborah Bird. For more, come to EarthSky.org and search for natural disasters. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
Everybody's got a price. Everybody's gonna pay. 'Cause the $1 million man always gets his way.
Yeah, he always gets his way because he's got money. Because, you know, the nation's broke, but, you know, the billionaire class, they're very well off. Very happy. And I keep hearing this frame over and over and over again. We're broke, Rick. I mean, we're just broke. Can't do anything. We can't invest in anything. We can't build roads and bridges. You know, we're just broke. And we're going to be like Greece immediately. We're just broke. So I see this Jeff Hyland, who wrote a piece for BBC, titled Inside the High-End Housing Market. And the quote that popped out at me is, almost everything we sell in Beverly Hills is $10 million or more, and it's all cash. There are no mortgages. It's all cash. Would it be nice to have that kind of money, that kind of asset to throw around? But the nation's broke, Rick. Didn't you know? It's broke. Absolutely broke. And I look at our stat of the week from the folks over at the Too Much Online blog. In fact, they're saying that, you know, Wall Street executives are kind of looking reasonable now. They're not looking so bad. When you look at Facebook's top guys, who their top executive took $83 million last year, you compare that to J.P. Morgan Chase, who shelled out $79 million to its top executives. Here's the difference. According to Fortune, the Facebook top executives, the ones who took $83 million, they managed just 3,200 staffers, while J.P. Morgan Chase's top executives managed almost 240,000. So I guess, you know, per person, per J.P. Morgan, maybe not a bad investment. Maybe not at all. Yeah, right. If you buy it, if you believe that, I've got a bridge. In fact, I got a couple of them. And here in Pennsylvania, to go even further, they're not crumbling, the ones I've got for sale. So there you go. Anyway, I got an email from Andy who said your show is a great source of information. You disseminate that what won't be heard anywhere else. That's why I listen. Just wanted to verify a couple of numbers. I talked about a Gallup poll back last week, and he went through and he named it a little mistake. He says that I made a quick mistake. The reality is look, Gallup, according to them, in 2011, health insurance provided by employers dropped to 44.6. That is the lowest point that it's been since employers began offering health insurance. In 2010, it was 45.8. In 2008, it was 49.2. So we were seeing a steady decline. And I really thought once it broke 50%, and this was back, a couple, 2007, when it broke 50%, I said at that point you're then going to start seeing people going, hey, we need to go to a non-employer-based system. Maybe that number is 40%. I don't know where the breaking point to where people wake up and go, why do I want my job, why do I want my health care tied to my job? And you look at the poll went a little bit further. The higher wages, the people who had like $90,000 a year, they got employer-based health care at about 70.4%. As where if you made 36 grand or less, just 23%. So, again, this is another one of those moments where health care, are you in the middle class or aren't you? Is that moment where you go, are we a two-class society, the have health care and the don't have health care? And all I hear the cons talking about and the radical right, they're just all a Twitter about, well, we've got to repeal Obamacare. Well, what are you going to replace it with? I've yet to hear a rational idea of what to replace it with. I keep hearing, the same pay or die idea. I keep hearing that. But nothing else. Oh, we need the free market. The free market will dictate. Because Obamacare has death panels. Obamacare is going to ration. But the fact that you don't have money and you can't get care, that doesn't matter? Evidently not to the cons. Because they all seem to believe, as Bush once famously said, that, well, if you're sick, you just go to the emergency room, right? If you're sick, you just go right to the doctor, and it's not a big thing.
People have access to health care in America. After all, just go to an emergency room.
That's it. Pretty simple. But this is also the guy who said this.
For a century and a half now, America and Japan have formed one of the great and enduring alliances of modern times.
Century and a half. 150 years. Century and a half. Great and enduring relationship with the Japanese. Except for that time where they bombed our Pearl Harbor and then we nuked them. Except for that. Everything was wonderful except for that. But, never mind. And again, I go back to this because, you listen to that. He really, just dumb. Which is what I think the Republicans are masters at doing. At promoting dumb. If you've listened to the history that they've come out with, it's amazing to me. How they, on the spot, rewrite history, and then when you call them on it, well, that's not what I meant. Well, that's what you said. And you got Alan West, who evidently has gone after Think Progress for collecting 15 of his dumbest quotes. And he's all upset that someone's paying attention to what he's saying. It's nuts. Just nuts. Oh, I'll tell you, wake up, America. Stop watching the Idiot Box. Turn off the TV. Think for a change. The story over at Forbes has me scratching my head going, hey, I think I like Citizens United. Oh, yeah, great idea. Sheldon Adelson, the billionaire behind Gingrich, he is saying he might give $100 million to Newt or some other Republican candidate because he hates Obama. What I find amazing about Sheldon Adelson, understand Sheldon's net worth, and this is by Forbes calculations, I didn't think this up, under the Obama administration, during this time that Obama's been president, his net worth has increased by $21.6 billion. He's now the GOME's $25 billion man. And now he's looking to buy himself a candidate and you know, a seat in the White House. And I guess when you've got $25 billion, because remember, we're broke. Country's broke. We can't afford anything. But we can give $100 million to Gingrich to run smear ads. Does that sound broke to you? No, it sounds like bad resource management. That's what it sounds like. But I keep hearing people say, well, we need to start cutting those welfare programs. $100 million would feed a lot of kids, man. $100 million would get some health care for a lot of people. But I guess we don't think in those terms. What we think of is, hey, that'll buy in a lot of negative attack ads, which has increased by more than 50% this primary season. Because you've got all these attack ads out there. And it's funny as you're watching the GOME attacking each other, which I'm happy for. Now, 50% of more than 50% of the ads, attack ads. Compare that to 2008, where just 6% were attack ads. And, you know, the strategist people are saying, well, it's those super PACs. You know, that's the reason it's gone up. No, I think it's all the money, and I think it's the fact that they're insane. You look at the latest round of campaign finance reports. Gingrich and Romney, they seem to be spending money faster than they can raise it. Santorum, he's getting a lot of small donors, but not making a big boatload of money, but he got $1 million donation to his Red, White, and Blue fund, their super PAC, from guess who? The Louisiana energy executive, William Dore. So, you think about Santorum, who talks culture war and family values. Where's he getting his money from? Alcohol and tobacco and gas. Okay, yeah, all right. I'm with you, Rick. I'm with you. Good family values. Anyway, big energy and the big hedge funds, they seem to be the biggest backers to the GOME super PACs. They have the pro-Romney super PAC added $6.6 million to its coffers in January, including $500,000 from Alliance Coal CEO Brian Cover, and also Caxton Alternative Management. So hedge fund and coal, $500,000 from each of those. So a cool $1 million. Don't you think we should know? Don't you think we should know who's behind the attacks? I mean, really? I mean, when all of this money goes into these super PACs and the Karl Rove's group, don't you think at some point we should have the right to know who's smearing and who's doing this stuff? See, I do, and I think the candidate should be the one putting out the message. I think the candidate should be the one. If you're going to use a candidate's name, it should be his message. This way we talk about what people are for more than what they're against, because I'm a for guy. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
I've never been on welfare. That's one place I won't be. I'll be working. As long as my two hands are fit to use, I'll drink my beer in a tavern, sing a little bit of these working men.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
This is WFTE 90.3 FM Mount Cobb and W289 AU 105.7 FM Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listen to us throughout Northeast Pennsylvania or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Warehouse workers are calling on Walmart to address issues with contractors that violate labor laws. On Thursday, workers in Southern California attempted to deliver a petition to one such contractor, Schneider Logistics. The petition calls on the company to rescind a plan to fire 100 workers. Warehouse Workers United secured an injunction demanding wages they allege had been stolen by the company. They say they were paid less than minimum wage, denied overtime, and weren't paid for lunch breaks. The workers rallied on Thursday to deliver the petition to a local warehouse, and the petition was refused at the door. Nick Allen is with Warehouse Workers United.
What happened here is such an obvious illustration of how this management treats these workers. They will not accept a simple written petition signed by these workers asking for their basic rights. They will not even take it to read it. That is the level of disrespect these workers experience every day.
The largest restaurant group in Florida has refused to weigh in on an effort to reduce wages for tipped workers in the state. Darden Group, which owns restaurants such as Red Lobster, issued a statement that due to economic conditions, this is not the right time to be having a discussion about cutting wages for servers. The bill would see the minimum wage for tipped workers cut from $4.65 per hour to the federal minimum of $2.13 per hour. However, the proposal does include a guarantee for employees of nearly $10 per hour for tips and wages combined. OSI, a restaurant group that owns businesses such as Outback, has said it supports the measure. During a rally last week led by Unite Here, restaurant employee Erica Feliciano said the move was a step backwards.
Minimum wage is $4-something an hour, and we want to cut it by $2. I feel like we're going back, 10 years ago.
Unite Here represents workers at Disney who will be opening 2014 contract negotiations just as the new wage goes into effect, if it passes.
Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Last week we talked about this Heartland Institute and these documents that came to light. And there's some people who were surprised by it. I think most people who were paying attention said, well, duh. This is something we've known for years. This is just not one more piece of evidence to say what we've known all along. That, they want to get into our kids. They want to get into their minds. They want to influence academics. I look at the Koch brothers funding, Florida State University gave $2 million to the economics department so they can have veto power over any professor hired. They want to control the message. And that's what this is really about. But here to talk a little bit more about it is David Waldman. He's a contributing editor over at dailycos.com. David, thanks for taking time for me.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
I look at these documents, and to me, and I think most of the people that I know, there's nothing new here. This is just what we've known, but it's actually on paper.
Yeah, absolutely. And most of the documents that they got a hold of illustrate is, in fact, exactly what everybody has known about the Heartland Institute all along, which is that they're in the business of perpetuating the climate science denial machine. And so that was no surprise. But the one that raised eyebrows, and as it happens, the one document that Heartland Institute now is denying is actually theirs, is the one that outlines this program of getting their program into the schools as part of the curriculum. And although they deny that this originated with them, it actually almost exactly mirrors a program which is already in place and being funded by a number of their partners in the American Legislative Exchange Council that was reported on in June in the Washington Post. So I suppose they could deny that they're the original source, but they can't deny that this is something they're behind.
What's amazing to me is, you know, how little the professors and these really who are supposed to be really smart people dedicated to their craft, how cheap they come.
Yeah. Well, what's really upsetting about it, I think, and at least in the program that this document was describing and that the Washington Post was describing, is that they're going even younger than that. This is actually a K through 12 program.
Yep.
In addition to, buying their way into being able to give the thumbs up and thumbs down on hiring and tenure for professors at the collegiate level, this is something where they're trying to get into your kids' grade school science program to teach them that, for instance, burning coal is good for the atmosphere.
Yeah,
that the earth is deficient in carbon dioxide.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I mean, you know, last year this Talisman company, one of the drillers here in Pennsylvania, came out with Talisman Terry, the friendly Fracosaurus coloring book. I mean, you know, they want them at 2-3. They don't want them up. They want them all the way from. In fact, if they could do something where they get them in utero, I think they would do that.
They very well may.
And in fact, you know, based on what the Republicans are doing with this whole abortion thing, maybe that'll be the next bill. The transvaginal ultrasound will coincide with some stimulus in utero to the baby's brain there too.
Yes, a sound truck that could be hooked up to it so that you can blast the message in utero. Not surprising, and also not unfamiliar. A lot of the same people who run this sort of program through the ALEC front are veterans of the same wars in the tobacco industry, who always denied that they were marketing to underage smokers, but were doing so with cartoon figures. So for them to carry it over into coloring books about fracking and how friendly it is to poison your water isn't much of a surprise either.
No, I mean, none of this is a surprise. And I think what now maybe the mainstream corporate-controlled for-profit media may report on is, as you've said, ALEC, this is their agenda. And the billionaire class has used this American Legislative Exchange Council to get their vision out, which, you know, I look at the woman in Florida who proposed a piece of legislation from ALEC and didn't even bother to take their name out of it.
Yeah. Well, very disturbing, and, you know, just sort of reveals the level at which they're working. A lot of state legislators are part-timers, and a lot of them not very well compensated either, but they're public employees, and some of them only are working a few months out of the year, and so it's understandable. But they're not professional legislators in the way we think of members of Congress who are year-round working on legislation, holding committee meetings, et cetera. And so it's difficult for people without the staff or access to the research to really get down into the details of state legislation, although, you know, that's by design. They're not really supposed to be there tinkering too much. But ALEC makes it very easy, and it makes it simple for very conservative members of state legislatures to look like legislative stars. They're handed entire pieces of legislation that are, you know, impressively written if you ignore how terrible they are for the environment and others. But they're written, of course, by Washington lobbyists, the very highly paid folks at that, and then handed over and submitted wholesale. And like you said, they often forget to take even the identifying markers out of this thing. But that's part of the game plan. That's something Tommy Thompson used to say, former governor of Wisconsin, why he loved going to ALEC conventions was specifically because he could pick up pieces of legislation, take them home, change the name on the front, and presto, it's his, and he looks like a genius.
Insta bill. You know, when I was in school, and, you know, I'm finishing up my master's degree, if I were to do that, I wonder what would happen to me if I decided to take a David Waldman piece and take the title, change the title, and put my name on it. I wonder what the professors would do. I wonder what my teachers, my Catholic, the nuns when I was in Catholic school, I wonder what they would have done to me.
Well, I think everybody knows what they would have done. They would have thrown you right out of school because it's cheating. And for some reason, people don't label it as such in this context. I mean, there are such things as using model legislation, but even that is a cover game. Usually when you refer to something like model legislation coming from some group, it's normally understood to be something where you've impaneled a group of academics that's ideologically balanced and that includes experts from across the spectrum. to bring together strictly the most conservative members of the state legislatures and corporate partners, and then put stuff out under the rubric of model legislation, is a fraud to begin with, just on its own. Then the fact that they will take their name and put on something that they didn't write and submit it in their legislature is a second level of fraud. And this program of trying to reprogram educational curricula to fool kids at an early age is just another level of fraud that just makes it even worse.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I look at this whole ALEC thing, and this is the ultimate public-private partnership to screw workers and their families, and basically, you know, anybody who doesn't make $1 million a year or more.
Yeah, and it's a comprehensive thing, and it kind of gets to sounding, you know, it sounds almost like scary conspiracy stuff, but all of the pieces of the way they operate, particularly in this educational field that we've been discussing, are very, I mean, they are instantly recognizable to anybody, any kind of voter, as all meshing very well with the corporate agenda. There's nothing, no part of it that requires a stretch of the imagination. The corporate interests push everywhere, in every state and every locality, for lower taxes, claiming that that's good for business or good for job creation, as if they've ever put any of that money toward job creation. But that's their main thrust, and that invariably has been causing so-called budget crises in states around the country. You cut your revenues in half and suddenly complain that your budget is out of balance.
We're broke.
Yeah, and of course, then they have to go looking for savings. And isn't it amazing that in dozens of states all across the country that have nothing to do with one another otherwise, except that they've all suddenly elected Republican governors and Republican legislatures, public education and teachers and teachers' unions come under attack as the most horrible example of waste in our budgets, and we really need to slash these things. So they attack the unions and try and cut teacher pay. Even if they can't succeed there, they simply slash spending on public education so that they can later, of course, point to it as a failure and say we need to voucherize. But in the meantime, this leaves impoverished school systems that can't afford to buy books and design serious scientific curricula for their kids. Well, along comes the ALEC members like the Coal Industry Association and the Fracking Industry Associations, who come along with grants to give you free curricula and materials to use in your science program, which is a godsend to the administrators of these public schools, who take it and only then, and presenting it to their kids, realize it's total and complete nonsense.
Yep.
And some of the most disgusting propaganda you've ever seen. People are coming home, parents are complaining to school systems that their kids bring home things that say, we got to start burning coal for no reason. We got to start dumping carbon dioxide into the atmosphere in order to save the planet. And parents are scratching their heads at how this stuff could get passed. And the way it gets passed is the school systems are between a rock and a hard place because of what Alex started doing a year ago on taxes.
Yep.
So it's all part of a program to move this stuff on a conveyor belt through public policy, through education, anywhere they can cram it in on you, they'll get you.
Well, I go back to Grover Norquist, who said this.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I could drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
And that's where we are. I mean, everything you've laid out is exactly what's happening here in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
They keep crying, oh, we're broke. We can't raise any revenue, so we got to gut education, $1 billion. And, oh, by the way, you can't raise your local taxes but a certain percent. So that means you've got to cut, gut, and punish. And, oh, hey, if Talisman Corporation wants to give your kids Talisman Terry, the friendly Fracosaurus, that's what you're going to get.
Yeah, and it's all you can afford until you submit to voucherization and privatization of the schools in the same way that they were hoping you would accept voluntarily. If not, they'll squeeze you out by giving you no reason to go to a public school. Teachers who aren't professionalized and curricula that doesn't make any sense.
Now, and submit is the perfect word for that, because that's what they're trying to do. Last line of questioning I've got for you. You know, you look at this document, you look at ALEC, you look at the direction of the presidential candidates, the discussion that's going on there. It seems all of this is hand in hand with the GOME and the big corporate special interest. I mean, we are really seeing a well-oiled, fine-tuned propaganda machine, and it's a major political party in this country being controlled by it.
Yeah, and it's why you're beginning to see even the normally tight-lipped justices of the Supreme Court saying we really need to start revisiting how we allow elections to be funded in this country. The Citizens United decision has worked out as an unmitigated disaster. Even the conservative justices that thought, well, okay, you know, individuals and even corporations need to be given the ability to influence the political climate. I don't think anybody anticipated, everyone thought, well, you know, there might be anonymous donations, but I don't think anybody ever anticipated just having loud and proud billionaire personal sponsors of presidential candidates.
Having their own pet presidential candidate, right.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, I'm watching people, these candidates, go through the processes of looking for Secret Service protection, and I'm wondering why you bother protecting this guy. You should be protecting, I guess, if anybody, the millionaire who's pulling his strings. I don't know, I mean, I guess he can hire his own private security, but they love government perks just as much as anybody else.
More so. That's probably how most of them made their money.
Yeah, exactly.
You want to talk about welfare queens right there.
Exactly. About the biggest draws on the system that anybody can find. And, I mean, these things that have come about, the pooling of these enormous corporate resources, I mean, ALEC has existed for some time. And it's only getting serious attention in the mainstream and traditional press now. That's true. But thankfully, it is starting to break through. But they have existed for some time, and I think that they were just kind of maybe kept in check by the amount of money that corporations could at the time safely funnel into, obviously, political activity. And now they've just blown off the barn doors, and they can go wild.
Yeah, I mean, they were part of the, if you've ever read the Powell memo, the Supreme Court Justice Lewis Powell wrote a memo on how to save free enterprise. I think ALEC was one of the groups that they set up back in 1973, along with a lot of the propaganda think tanks of that era. And that was part of the business community saying, hey, here's a boatload of money. We need to get the message out. And I think labor need, and I've been saying this for the longest time, labor and progressive groups need to learn that lesson and get behind and promote themselves as well. Although I know they don't have near the resources that the billionaire class does.
Yeah, well, that puts us at a significant disadvantage, of course. But, you know, thankfully, the one thing that we do have pretty much remains the same, which is just the numbers on our side. There just aren't that many billionaires. It's easy to get drowned out by their money. But, you know, so long as they actually count votes and count heads in this country, there's at least some hope that by showing up in numbers at the right time in the right places, we can fight back.
And they're making that even harder to do, too. David Waldman, I appreciate the time. Contributing editor over at DailyCos.com. We've got a link to his work over at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on David Waldman's name. David, thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick.
Let's take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Don't know much about the science world. Don't know much about the French I took, but I do know that I need you. And if you fall for all the crap I spew, what a wonderful world this would be.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
If an apple a day keeps the doctor away, will Apple Inc.'s public image get healthier now that it has hired an organization to monitor labor abuses in the foreign factories that make its products? Practically all of the 70 million iPhones and 30 million iPads that the computer giant sold last year were produced in Chinese factories that don't exactly shine with good working conditions. One of the largest, for example, was recently exposed for 72-hour work weeks, forced overtime, child labor, chemical poisonings, deadly explosions, and other rottenness. However, after years of refusing to allow any independent scrutiny of such facilities, Apple honchos have now thrown open the doors of its foreign suppliers, loudly announcing that an outside group called the Fair Labor Association would be free to inspect their Chinese factories. Bravo, right? Apple CEO Tim Cook positively glowed with self-satisfaction, declaring that workers everywhere had the right to safe and fair workplaces. And now he pledged FLA would be able, quote, to independently assess his company's performance. Independently? Not so fast, bucko. It turns out that FLA is notorious among anti-sweatshop groups for its coziness with corporate interests. How cozy? It is largely funded by its corporate members, the very firms being inspected. Indeed, in January, Apple became a corporate member of FLA just in time to go public with its new pledge of openness. Scott Nova is head of the Worker Rights Consortium, a legitimate anti-sweatshop group. As he dryly observed about the FLA-Apple deal, independent monitoring means you're generally independent of the companies. This is Jim Hightower saying, to find out if FLA does an honest assessment or just polishes the apple, go to workerrights.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
You know, you look at this and you go, hey, at what point do we wake up and realize that the billionaire class, they don't have our interests at heart? And when you see the Foster Freezes come out for Santorum, and you see the Sheldon Adelsons coming out for Gingrich, and you see the Romney money, you go, what do they know about us? What do they know about what it's like to work for a living? And I look at this story in Florida, and it's... As I talked to you last week about this Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association, who the woman who runs it, you know, makes like, I forget what it was, like $800,000 a year or something obnoxious, representing these big chains trying to steal tip money away from waiters and waitresses. But really, is that how you made your $800 or $900, whatever she made, $1 million a year? Who knows? Is this how you did it? By screwing this little person? This person who's just trying to eke out an existence and feed their families. So I'm reading the follow-up story to this, which is when it passed the state Senate committee in Florida. Now understand, they had a minimum wage increase in the state that included tipped employees. So you had to make minimum wage. And it said that, you know, they had to make a certain wage. And I think for them, tipped workers, I think it was $4.65 an hour, which is what the tipped employees minimum wage was. Now on the federal level, it's $2.13. So they just can't survive paying that extra, $2.42. That would just kill them. Just can't do it. Not gonna happen. $2.52. Not gonna happen. Never, not even clinically. So it's in this committee, the state Senate committee, where the committee on tourism and commerce, this woman, her name is Nancy Dietert. She's a Republican from Venice, Florida. She stands up and says, hey, we're being brave and bold and being statesmen and not politicians. And I'm going, brave and bold? Brave and bold is taking from workers? Brave and bold? Really? By stealing from the lowest of the low-paid worker? Really? And evidently, yes. Now, that's what they're going on. Because the big billionaire class said, well, we just can't afford it. We can't afford to pay those workers. Now, understand, they've got a minimum wage system set up. Part of the bill is going to say they got to make, like, I think it was $9.98 an hour. That's the minimum that they can work. And now you're adding in the tips. So now what's going to happen, and this is all part of the gig, you're going to end up having scenarios where they're going to raise the minimum amount of tip per check. To calculate this, right now it's 8%. They're taxed on the federal level at 8% of whatever the check is. Whether you gave them a tip of 8% or not, whether you gave them a tip or not, they're paying 8% of that check to the Fed, to the government. So I envision at some point in Florida you seeing that go up so that they can get away from even paying the minimum of $9.98. This is a screw job, and it's a damn shame. But it is what it is. This is the direction the country has gone. And why? Because the billionaire class wants it. And I look at this Palm Beach Post interview with David Coke. I'll get it right one of these days. Coke. Well, the other applies. He's described Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, as impressive and courageous, and said, he went after those public unions, and we need to keep them in check. He said that restricting collective bargaining rights was critically important, and warned that if Walker was recalled, there'd be no stopping the unions then, no stopping them. And I go back and he said they spent a lot of money in Wisconsin to get to this point. They're also going to spend more, so expect that to happen. Like we said, the recall election could be $60, $70 million, which, again, I seem to think, there's a way of doing a much better job of allocating resources. But anyway, I asked the question, why is it critically important to restrict workers' rights? Why is that what they view as critically important? Well, because they know unions are the only way workers get a say on the job. Unions are the only way you're going to get a slice of the pie or even a crumb of the pie. And they don't even want you to have that. So when I look at the Koch brothers and I look at all of this, the Heartland Institute and Alec and all of this well-oiled machine, this propaganda machine that has done a masterful job, and you talk to people on a superficial level, and you immediately, when I go into crowds and I'll talk to a couple of people, you get platitudes, you get talking points thrown at you. But when you start really talking about what's important and how you get where, you understand that this country is far more progressive than the mainstream corporate-controlled for-profit media wants you to believe, or the Koch brothers or the billionaire class wants you to believe. They all want you to think, oh, we're a conservative nation. We're not. We're a forward-looking nation. And yeah, I would say, we're optimistic to a degree, but we're not stupid, I would hope. What the right keeps shoveling at us, what the neocons keep shoveling at us, what these cons keep shoving at us, is we need to go back. We need to go back when the billionaires were free to roam. And free to do whatever it is they want. Because, after all, they're the job creators. And you workers should have nothing to say about it. I mean, it's really watching Mitt Romney dance around the union issue, because, watching him dance around it is really quite hysterical. Because he doesn't want to, the union vote in this country is still substantial, more than the Tea Party. And if you enrage them, which Wisconsin did, because I can't imagine that there is going to be a union member or a union family member who's going to vote for a Republican in this next election. I can't imagine that happening. Because of the attacks on collective bargaining, not just in Wisconsin, but across the nation, and brought to you by Alec and the well-oiled machine. And you better, if you don't know that's what happened, you better wake up. I mean, it's amazing how all of the same policy, all of the same laws keep popping up in different states. Steal collective bargaining rights, go after the gays, go after abortion, and it's really well timed, because they don't really want to talk about what's going on. That they crashed the economy and they're robbing us blind, even to this day. Sheldon Adelson, his fortune up to $25 million, made $21.6 million in the years that Obama has been in office, and he wants him out. Evidently, that's not enough. There was an opportunity to make $22 billion, and he should have done that. Because Obama's saying that maybe he should pay some tax on that money, and maybe we could use that money a little bit better than funding someone like Gingrich. Maybe we could supply money for education so we don't have to have a backwards education system, which is where I see us going. Where I see us going, and what scares the hell out of me, is that my kids are going to end up with books brought to you by this corporation, and this test brought to you by XYZ Corporation. We've already seen out in Colorado, report cards are selling advertisement space out of the report cards. It's nuts. And this whole pro-business, we need to be more business-friendly nonsense, at some point we got to wake up. And the reality is, We're not seeing many people going on strike anymore. What's happening is they're being thrown out. Workers are being kicked to the curb, locked out by these big multinationals, these big corporations with all this money. And when we come back, we're going to talk with Steve Bertelli, International Vice President for Region 3 of the Bakery and Confectionery Workers Union. Their journey for justice as the workers at American Crystal and Cooper Tire start their march tomorrow. Quick break, right back after this.
On the radio, with my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat, it is my business hat. I'm up to 1 a.m., I must tell you that. I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Considering Earth as a whole, the year 2011 had the highest economic losses due to earthquakes on record. It also had the highest economic losses due to natural disasters overall on record.
The earthquake analysis released in early 2012 came from the Center for Disaster Management and Risk Reduction in Germany. According to their report, earthquakes and their consequences, such as tsunamis and landslides, caused damages of $365 billion U.S. dollars. Over half of that was from the earthquake on March 11th of 2011 and the resulting tsunami in Japan.
The report said that the two countries hardest hit by earthquakes were New Zealand, with a large earthquake near Christchurch in February 2011, and Japan. The Insurance Information Institute in the U.S. and the global reinsurance firm Munich Re in Germany both issued reports calling the Japan earthquake the most costly natural disaster of any kind in history.
Globally, the Institute said, 2011 was the costliest year ever for natural disasters, and the earthquake and tsunami in Japan were a big part of that. They accounted for more than half of the total damage from natural disasters worldwide. I'm Jorge Salazar.
And I'm Deborah Bird. For more, come to earthsky.org and search for natural disasters. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Come all ya good workers, doing news to you out there. Pull out the good old union as you're in here to clear. Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can also email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So workers from Cooper Tire and Rubber Company in Findlay, Ohio, are now in Fargo, North Dakota. They're in Fargo to join with locked-out workers from American Crystal Sugar Company. And both sets of locked-out workers are kicking off a 1,000-mile road trip from Fargo, North Dakota to Findlay, Ohio, highlighting the plight of locked out workers across the country. And look, you know, we've been saying, no, you're not seeing as many strikes anymore. Now you're seeing companies, you're saying, you know what, either you take what we're going to give you, what we're going to impose on you, or we're going to kick you to the curb. No negotiating, no sitting down talking, just you're out the door on the curb. And our laws are so fractured and broken. Sadly, it seems to be increasing and working. That's why I've asked Steve Bertelli, International Vice President for Region 3 at the Bakery and Confectionery Workers, to come talk to us. He's at the spot where I guess it's going to start tomorrow. Steve, thanks for taking time for me.
Glad to be here.
So tomorrow in Fargo, you're going to kick off this road trip, this from Fargo to Findlay, a journey for justice.
Correct. Yep, that's right. Starts tomorrow.
So what are you doing along the way? You're going to leave Fargo, head all the way. That's a couple miles, a thousand miles at least?
It's 1,000 miles, 6 days, six different states. We're going to hit several major cities and what have you where we have activities scheduled. It will be constantly on the move trying to get out the word about lockouts. You know, it's the new strategy now.
Yeah, I mean, it's just amazing to me that our laws are so badly broken and fractured that that we continue to see 1890s style union busting going on in this day and age.
That's correct. That's correct. You know, and well, companies spend a lot of money on this, and it's a take it or leave it attitude. That's the way their attitude's been since the very beginning of this. In fact, the last time we sat down with the company, they basically told us, well, if you'd be gracious enough to recommend our final offer, we'll be glad to let you present that.
Wow. And again, you know, so much for negotiating and sitting down at the table. And this is where I've always said, I said at the beginning of the show, the reason I voted for Bill Clinton is he promised to get a strike replacement bill put in.
Correct.
Or a replacement bill overall.
Right.
Because, you know, this to me is one of those situations where it's kind of like a marriage. You've got, you know, both sides should be sitting down working things out. But when you give one side more power the other over the other, or you introduce a third party, you got problems.
Correct, correct. And what was amazing here is we finally were able to identify the five of their major areas they needed concessions in, and we met four of those areas. The fifth one we did not, and that had to do with seniority, and that was one we couldn't, you know, we couldn't give up. I mean, that's the cornerstone of our contract, and it's not just, you know, out-and-out seniority. There's a lot of hoops and fences you go through, and basically what the company wanted was the right to be able to hire whomever they wanted, whenever they wanted.
Without any say whatsoever by the union or the workers.
Correct. If a new job opened up, they could promote somebody from within. If they didn't feel like it, they could hire somebody from without.
And, you know, again, you need to go back to this idea, then what's the point?
Exactly.
Then you have no say, you have no recourse. And I guess from their perspective, that is the point.
Exactly.
They want dictatorial power. When you walk onto that job floor, you are theirs, and they want you to know it.
Right. And they want the unfettered right. I mean, right now they've got to go through certain, you know, they got to give us the opportunity to try out the job. And if we can't do it, then they can't hire to the outside. But they want to get past that and not even bother having to do that any longer.
You know, one of the means that we've been seeing for so long, especially since the recession, the Great Republican Recession started, is that unions, you know, they want companies to go out of business, and they're not willing to work, and they're just, it's too difficult. And yet every union person I talk to, every leader I talk to, every elected leader says, you know what, we're given concessionary contracts. We're helping these companies stay in business. And I look at one of the companies that you're having this journey with, the Cooper Tire thing. The steelworkers actually built a trade case for the U.S. government to take to the World Trade Organization, won those jobs back by, you know, getting some tariffs, and now this is how the workers are repaid. And I would even say that the workers are being punished because they brought those jobs back.
Safe to say, it's a different world right now, and this tactic is unbelievable. You know, it affects 1,300 people, not just people. I should say 1,300 families here in the Red River Valley. Then you got 1,050 at Cooper Tire. A little over a year ago, we had 350 locked out in, or less than a year ago, in Keokuk, Iowa, at the Roquette plant.
Yep.
Same tactics.
Yep.
And I think there's a 3-year lockout going out on in Muscatine, Iowa, with USCW. So I mean, it's a course of action companies have chosen. And there's companies out there like Strom Engineering who are feeding on this and going to companies before they go to negotiations and tell them, we have an answer for you. Just buy into our program.
We'll supply you with all the scabs you need.
Exactly.
And, you know, as a society, I think we need to go back to how it was when I was a kid. I've told this story a couple of times. The guy who lived catty corner from my grandparents. My grandfather told me, you go anywhere near his kids, I'll beat you senseless. And, you know, I didn't disobey, didn't question. But as I got older, I said, you know, what's with that? It turns out that the guy who was about the same age as my grandfather, that guy had crossed the picket line for the railroad back like 50 years ago. And nobody in the neighborhood talked to him.
Yep.
And we need to go back to that. We need to return to the days where, you know, scabbing on somebody else's job is frowned upon.
Right. Well, this is turning worker against worker. This is exactly what it is.
And they are masterful at slicing and dicing and keeping us at each other's throats, because that's how they're able to profit.
That's correct. And that's what we're hoping this journey is going to bring forth. Help get that word out there to other folks and, you know, other places. of what's going on.
And the website is crystalgreed.com if you want to learn more information about what's going on here. Tell me a little bit about what's going on at American Crystal Sugar Company. This was a very fairly profitable company, as I understood.
Oh, very, very, very profitable. And it's a co-op, so it's owned by the growers, who are the farmers. So, you know, as a co-op, they've made a lot of money over the years with the sugar bill, you know, because that, there's a tariff on how much sugar can be brought into this country. So, in essence, sugars are kept at a certain price level, guaranteeing, you know, that there'd be a return for people that grow beets or process sugar in this country. You can't flood the market with excess sugar. So they've done very, very well. And the last 5 years have been highly profitable. They've done really, really fantastic.
Now, is there a brand that they produce that I cannot buy?
Yeah, well, there is. They have their own name brand, which is American Crystal Sugar. And you'll see, you see it on the shelves at, you know, a lot of different places, including, I think, Walmart carries them and some of the other national grocery stores. A lot of their product goes into, and this is tough for us as a union, because we represent individuals on both sides of this fence. We have companies that process or utilize the sugar in their products, you know, like bread, cakes, candy, what have you. So a lot of their sugar is actually even in that product, you know, union-made product.
Yeah, I look at this and it's almost, you know, they've got you in a tough situation, but at the end of the day, I am not gonna, my wife will be instructed no more, if that's what we're buying, no more of it.
Yeah. Trust me, I haven't bought any since this started.
Yeah, and as far as Walmart, any, no self-respecting working person, I think would go there or, well, any of the other, big box retailers who have been screwing the workers in this country, for the last 30 years.
Yeah.
But anyway, the big journey starts tomorrow. Where's your first stop?
First stop's going to be Minneapolis. The kickoff is tomorrow here in Fargo, which there'll be a rally and we're going to deliver. I think, don't quote me, but I think we got like about 30,000, 35,000, signatures on a petition to be delivered to the company.
Nice.
And, that's our big kickoff. And then there'll be, a little rally and they'll be taking off and they'll be heading to Minneapolis. They're going to spend, tomorrow night in Minneapolis, some activities in Minneapolis, and from there they're going to go on Thursday to Madison, where there's some Madison, Wisconsin, where there's some activities scheduled, you know, and then on Friday they'll be moving on down the road. They'll be going to, let me make sure I get it right, Milwaukee, and they've got activities scheduled there. And, from Milwaukee they'll leave and go to Chicago on Saturday. Spend the day in Chicago on Saturday and some of the morning, and then after that, head for Findlay, Ohio, where it'll end on Monday.
Well,
at Cooper Tire Plant for Hands Around the Plant rally at 4:30 in the afternoon.
Well, I can't wait to hear how this goes. We're hoping to get someone every day as the rally, as the journey for justice continues, to highlight this and to keep an eye on it and to let people know what's going on.
We'll be more than glad to do that. We have four from, actually this convoy is made up of, two groups. Four from, the steel workers. They sent some of their, road warriors. We've got what we call ambassadors, four ambassadors. They're rank and file people who go out and tell their story. They're people that work in, the Crystal Sugar plant. You know, they've been affected by this. So they're the ones going out and spreading this story.
Well, those are the folks we're going to want to talk to as this goes on, because I'd love to see what kind of reaction we're getting, because I think at some point we need something to focus on. Workers need to see that there's something being done, and this is a step in the right direction. Steve Bertelli, I appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
It is believe that a little hard work is good for the soul. If this is true, then the history of child workers in the United States is a soulful tale. The first child laborers landed in Virginia in the year 1619. These immigrant children found slave working conditions and poverty wages in the New World. As the years passed, little changed. The average child worker toiled 16 to 18 hours per day, 6 days a week in factories and textile mills. Education was a luxury, and many believed a loss on working children. Charles Harding, president of the Merchants Woolen Company, stated, "There is such a thing as too much education for working people sometimes. I have seen cases where young people are spoiled for labor by too much refinement." Labor unions, consumer groups, and parent coalitions all work to shorten hours, ease conditions, and ultimately end exploitative child abuses. Baby strikes in Paterson, New Jersey, and Allentown, Pennsylvania, demanding 11 and 12-hour workdays were fought vehemently by mill and factory owners. The Pennsylvania legislature was the first to consider prohibiting child workers in 1833, and consider is all Pennsylvania did until July of 1903, when Mother Jones led the March of the Mill Children from Philadelphia to Oyster Bay, New York, in an attempt to influence President Theodore Roosevelt. In 1836, Massachusetts was the first state to pass a law restricting the use of children in manufacturing. And 102 years later, the United States Supreme Court ruled the Walsh-Healy Act restricting the use of child labor as constitutional. Also in 1938, Congress passed the Fair Labor Standards Act, which put more stringent restrictions on the use of child labor. While hard work teaches discipline, self-reliance, and responsibility, the exploitive nature of our past must remind us that what we have today, we mustn't take for granted, for the days of tomorrow are doomed to repeat if we ignore those lessons hard learned. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. So in New Jersey, they approved the Marriage Equality and Religious Exemption Act, was vetoed by Chris Christie. And he knew that was going to happen. And he ran, and his position, I think, is pretty clear. He knew he was going to veto it. He said he ran on it during the campaign in 2009. And said, look, you know, that's what I did. You know, and you knew it when they voted for him. He's got an interesting position, though. Put it on the ballot. Let people vote on it. Are we a nation that believes in a constitution, or don't we? And, you know, there's part of me that says, yeah, let's put it up for a vote. But there's also part of me that this is an issue for the courts to decide. What is constitutional? What is not? Is it right to use the government to deny people rights? I mean, you know, there's that whole due process, that whole equal in the eyes of the law kind of thing. Just interesting. But there, you know, a couple of gay things going on this week. You know, this sheriff from Arizona, kind of interesting, running for Congress. It turns out, in what they're claiming is, that he threatened his boyfriend or love interest or whatever he is, threatened to deport him. Now, this is a guy who was, you know, pretty staunchly anti-immigration, one of these guys out there beating the drum. And it's, for me, the first thing I thought is you're cavorting with someone who's an illegal immigrant that you're going to be able to threaten to deport. That tells me, if that's true, that this is somebody of a certain mentality, should be a Republican. And it's a good thing that he is, because that is their mentality, that control. There's part of me that also thinks that, you know, maybe it's a BS story. You know, the guy probably is gay, and he is gay, and he admitted it, and that the whole deportation thing was just a jilted lover. I don't know. But what I find interesting, and this is where you're seeing the GOP splitting, and I'm kind of enjoying the fact that the hypocrites are being exposed for who they are, one, but more importantly, you're seeing the policy splitting, which maybe we'll have some consensus in this country after all. You look at this guy and you go, He's come out and said, look, people should be able to get married. The government should not be in the business of telling who, people who and who they cannot, you know, marry. Now, if the church wants to recognize the marriage or not, that's up to them. No one is saying that, you know, the Catholic Church has to recognize gay marriage. They don't have to. The eyes of the law. And that's where the splitting line is. It's the eyes of the law. Do I want the law used against me? And the answer is no. Or anybody else for that matter. On any number of issues. You know, this isn't mine, and I don't care one way or another. I see it as a basic fairness issue. And then you see these right-wingers out there who are, you know, like Larry Craig, who was, you know, a basher, and Bob Allen, who, you know, him and his, you know, we're gonna make it a felony, for men to have sex in a bathroom. You know, good luck on that. And then you find out he's doing it. Now you see this guy, like we talked about last year, or last week, this conservative talk show host, supposedly very popular, right-winger down there in Houston, who backs into a bouncer's car at a gay bar, and then runs off. And the Houston police don't do anything. Now I just found out that the Houston police are going to have an investigator, not only investigate the accident, but also the department's response to it. And there's going to be an internal investigation on how it's been handled. Beyond this, for me, has nothing to do with the hit and run accident. Has to do with you've got a right winger in a gay bar. What was he doing there? Chances are he was going there. Why? The reason everybody else went there. Not because they served a good cup of coffee or the decor was very nice. No. He's gay. And I'm okay with that. But will the right wing? And that's kind of an interesting position. Where will the right wing come down on this? Is his career done regardless? Interesting. But while we're focusing on that, while we're focusing on the shiny thing, the distraction, the abortion, the gay marriage, all of that, you're looking at what went on this past weekend in Vancouver. They had their big science convention, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. They held their big meeting. And, you know, the message was, look, we got to get out and talk about what science is. They're saying there's an attack on science. And they're saying, look, you know, the reality is the public does not understand science. They're being told by the Santorums and all the, and the Heartland Institute that, that global warming, that's just a hoax. It's a bunch of hokum. We couldn't possibly do anything like that. Yet they had, you know, there's a lot of evidence out there. But what you're seeing from the right is this whole kind of dumbing down. And I point to Santorum's quote. He went after Obama, saying that, you know, Obama's theology is not based on the Bible, which was kind of a hysterical statement. But, you know, he said, well, it's not based on the Bible because the earth is here to serve man. And he has the idea that man is here to serve the earth. And he's like, no, it's a phony ideal, and it's his theocracy. And I'm sitting there going, you know, what exactly are you talking about? And for those people on the right, you know, that's your basic dog whistle politic. That's denying science. That's running away from the realities of the planet's getting warmer, and we're burning fossil fuels, and we're contributing to this. Can we stop it? Can we slow the process? Can we do other things? Possibly. And that means doing things smarter, doing things a little differently. Change that the radical right not interested in at all. So then Santorum kind of turns it around and says, look, it's those liberals that are anti-science. They're the anti-science ones. You know, because they don't believe that the earth is here to serve man. And I'm just kind of scratching my head, and I'm thinking, who's sitting in the audience listening to this and going, yeah, earth's here to serve me. So let's burn coal and let's burn oil and let's burn baby burn. And that's kind of the message that they're spewing out there. And they're doing a great job of it. I mean, the believers. And there's a huge split in this country. Because evidently you can't be a believer and a knower. Somebody sent me bumper stickers, a bunch of bumper stickers on a form. And one of them says, I'll pray in school. If you promise not to pray in my school, I won't think in your church. And to me, that scares the hell out of me. Because there's some reality in that. You have people who, they just believe. I'm a believer. Well, what does that mean? Well, that means that no matter what I present to you, no matter what rational argument, no matter what fact-based argument I make to you, it's never going to influence your opinion. Because you believe. I'm a believer. So that means there's no talking to these people. And that's the Santorum crowd. So when he's out there pushing that, Obama's, his theology is not based on the Bible, that inflames the radical right, who they have been cultivating for a couple generations now. And I'm amazed at the insanity that you see. Before I came in today, I was talking to my wife, and I said, there's a part of me that's almost going, Canada's probably looking pretty good. I saw this letter written by a Republican from Fort Wayne, Indiana, one of the Indiana state representatives. And he's talking about why he's not going to sign on to recognizing the accomplishments, or just recognizing the anniversary of the Girl Scouts. Evidently, this is their 100th year in existence. So a lot of places are doing this. They're passing a little resolution, recognizing, it's 100 years, you've done great work. My daughter's in the Girl Scout thing, and, she does the whole, and sometimes, I go, maybe it's getting a little too thumperish for me, doing a little bit too much Bible beating. But, I don't think it's bad for her to experience something else. It's not bad for her to experience any other ideas, as long as she understands that, there are other ideas and you deal with people as they come. This guy, dead flat, set against it. Evidently, according to him, he talked to a well-informed constituent. I can't imagine who that is. And he did his words, not mine, a small amount of web-based research. And what he found was disturbing, that these Girl Scouts and their worldwide partner, the World Association of Girl Guides and Girl Scouts, they have a strategic affiliation with Planned Parenthood. Even though all the groups deny that they're anywhere interlinked, he knows that they are. Because one of the den mothers, she showed one of Planned Parenthood's educational pamphlets. And do you know what those pamphlets said? Pamphlets said there's no right or wrong way to have sex, and that is just plain wrong. So according to him and his little bit of research, which is probably, I don't even want to think about it, but he's going to not going to recognize the 100 years of Girl Scouts because of some bizarre idea that somehow they're indoctrinating little girls. And my wife goes to me, we sit around, we talk about abortion all the time. We sit around talking all the time. Me and the 9-year-olds, we talk about, sex all the time. That's all. So in fact, we make dolls so that they can have sex, evidently. That's probably what this guy thinks. And that is exactly why this guy should be nowhere near the halls of power. And I'm hoping the people of Indiana open their eyes and throw this guy right out on his you-know-what. When we come back, we're going to talk about how Virginia's gone nuts with their anti-abortion rhetoric and this whole state-sponsored rape thing. Back after this.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
This is WFTE 90.3 FM Mount Cobb and W289 AU 105.7 FM Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listen to us throughout Northeast Pennsylvania or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Warehouse workers are calling on Walmart to address issues with contractors that violate labor laws. On Thursday, workers in Southern California attempted to deliver a petition to one such contractor, Schneider Logistics. The petition calls on the company to rescind a plan to fire 100 workers. Warehouse Workers United secured an injunction from the company to not follow through with the plans on February 24th. The employees had filed suit in 2011, demanding wages they allege had been stolen by the company. They say they were paid less than minimum wage, denied overtime, and weren't paid for lunch breaks. The workers rallied on Thursday to deliver the petition to a local warehouse, and the petition was refused at the door. Nick Allen is with Warehouse Workers United.
What happened here is such an obvious illustration of how this management treats these workers. They will not accept a simple written petition signed by these workers asking for their basic rights. They will not even take it to read it. That is the level of disrespect that these workers experience every day.
The largest restaurant group in Florida has refused to weigh in on an effort to reduce wages for tipped workers in the state. Darden Group, which owns restaurants such as Red Lobster, issued a statement that due to economic conditions, this is not the right time to be having a discussion about cutting wages for servers. The bill would see the minimum wage for tipped workers cut from $4.65 per hour to the federal minimum of $2.13 per hour. However, the proposal does include a guarantee for employees of nearly $10 per hour for tips and wages combined. OSI, a restaurant group that owns businesses such as Outback, has said it supports the measure. During a rally last week led by Unite Here, restaurant employee Erica Feliciano said the move was a step backwards.
Minimum wage is $4-something an hour, and we want to cut it by $2. I feel like we're going back, 10 years ago.
Unite Here represents workers at Disney, who will be opening 2014 contract negotiations just as the new wage goes into effect, if it passes.
Tell me what democracy looks like.
This is what democracy looks like.
Kill us, kill, kill us, kill.
What's injustice?
You can't pass it.
Workers' rights under attack. What do we do?
Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary for Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Absence works. Maybe it's the way it's being taught or the way that it's being applied out there. But the fact of the matter is, it is the best form of to teach our children.
I want to be a cowboy. You can be my cowgirl.
I got to tell you, I'm glad he is out of the race. There was one guy, and I know people were saying, well, how bad could it be? What trouble could a governor from Texas do? I'm sure they were being facetious, but you listen to that clip and that's their view. Just don't do it. Just like Ron and Nancy, just say no. Yeah. Anyway, 66% of folks in Virginia oppose a bill recently passed by their state legislature repealing a state law limiting firearm purchases to one per month. The same poll, some interesting numbers as well, found that Virginians, 55% of them, oppose the mandatory ultrasound bill for abortion patients, what some people have called the state-sponsored rape bill. And they're saying that that number will probably go up as they educate voters and they actually understand what a transvaginal ultrasound actually is. That's why we've asked Charlene Herring. She is a Virginia delegate from the 46th District there in Virginia to come talk about this. And also they've got another ALEC-sponsored personhood bill. Charnel, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you for having me on.
I look at this and, I remember the transvaginal ultrasound when my kids were born.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not something that is just, oh, well, you can do it in an office, and it's just not something that is just done. This is an invasive procedure.
Absolutely. It's very invasive. And, you know, I think when most people hear ultrasound, they think of the sort of jelly on the belly method, where it's on top of the skin, and this is actually going inside a woman's body. So it's very invasive procedure.
You know, the clip going around is some woman commentator, I don't know where she's from, made the dumb statement that, well, you know, the women didn't mind the transvaginal procedure that they had to get pregnant, so they shouldn't mind this either. Which, you know, I guess, you know, asking as a woman, doesn't it tick you off?
It ticks me off because it's sort of trying to make light of a very serious situation, but it also tells you where these proponents of this type of legislation are coming from. They don't even realize that, or it hasn't even dawned on them that what we're talking about is actually a crime. If you look at the Virginia Code, it can actually fall under rape or criminal object penetration because there's no bona fide medical reason to do a transvaginal probe before performing an abortion.
It just seems to me to be another one of those really mean-spirited, angry things by men who really don't like women all that very much.
Well, it's mean-spirited, and I think it's really what it is to punish a woman who decides to exercise her constitutional right to terminate a pregnancy. Yeah. And it violates a woman's right to privacy.
And the other part of this is, you know, I keep hearing people talk about, well, you know, the cost of health care is just going up, up, and up. As I remember it, this type of ultrasound was not cheap.
Oh, it's not cheap. Now, you know, the proponents will say, well, we are saying we'll give a list of free places that a woman can get it for free. But I think, again, they're missing the point. It's not the money that's the issue. It's the woman's privacy and her body, and to force a procedure on her is quite honestly barbaric.
And it'll only take 20 weeks to get that free ultrasound.
Right. It takes time, and, you know, a woman should have a right to get health care, and she may need to terminate the pregnancy because her life is at risk. Or her health is at risk. And, you know, it's really odd that legislators are proposing a medical procedure where going into the doctor's office and saying, hey, doc, you need to do this procedure first. You know, that's not our role. That should be between a doctor and a patient about what happens.
Now, as a legislator, have you gotten any feedback from the medical community? Because they can't be thrilled with being forced into this position either.
Oh, no, they're not thrilled at all, and I try to, you know, put amendments onto the bill just so that, you know, if they don't comply with the bill, that they won't face stiff fines. No, they're not happy at all.
Let me ask you this, because, you know, we've been hearing this whole moral conscience argument about contraception. Could it be that a doctor in your state would say, I have a moral objection to, if it becomes law, that I have a moral objection to doing this, therefore that they wouldn't have to and the woman wouldn't have to have it done?
Anything is possible, but that the way the bill is written, that doctor would face $2,500 in fines.
Even if he had a moral objection to it?
The way the bill is written, there's no moral objection, exception.
So let me get this straight. I keep hearing the radical right talking about, well, you know, if the church or if an employer has an objection to offering, if I've got this right, help me here. There's a moral objection to offering contraception, to stopping pregnancy from happening so it doesn't get to the point that you may choose to have an abortion, but we're going to force a doctor to do this in order to get to the, I'm missing something here.
Right. No, you're not missing anything. It just defies logic. And if they heard themselves speak, they realize that what they're saying doesn't make sense. And it's an unfortunate atmosphere we find ourselves in. I'm talking with you about this bill instead of about jobs and the economy, but they brought it up on themselves.
Yeah, but, you know, here's the thing. It's no wonder that Santorum's approval rating in 1 week among women dropped from 42 to 34%.
Absolutely. It's not surprising because it's an extreme agenda and it's not in touch with America. It's very extreme.
And what's interesting to me is that 34% still think that this is okay.
Right. And you know what? You can keep your personal beliefs to yourself, but when you impose that onto women and you go into a doctor's office and tell a doctor what to do and tell a woman what she needs to do, it's going too far.
Yeah, I mean, the other part of this is, you know, the GOP, they're the party who wants limited government. Get government out of my life. Yet,
right.
This seems to be pretty invasive, pretty intrusive.
Absolutely. Yeah, get government out of my life, except, you know what, you government, go on in into that doctor's office, and in fact, make the ultimate big government, and let's go into a woman's body with a probe that's not needed. That's really insulting to women.
Yeah, I think back to the Emma Goldman quote, who said, you know, it's time that women, men want women to have their mouths shut and their wombs open. And, you know, I think about that, and I'm going, wow, that's pretty, yeah, seems
yeah,
right.
It's profound.
And you look at that hearing they had in Congress, no women on the panel.
No women on the panel. And it shows you, it makes my jaw drop to even think that you can have a discussion about birth control or women's reproductive health in any manner and not have a woman part of the conversation. You know, this is what, 2012, and it's almost like we're back in 1912.
Absolutely. And,
yes.
And I'm hoping that, you know, some eyes are opening, because like my wife, for instance, she is not political. I don't think she has a political bone in her body. And that's okay, because I'm political enough for us and a whole bunch of other people. But she looked at this and she's going, wait a minute, excuse me?
Right.
Who are you to tell me what I can and I cannot do?
Exactly. Exactly. And it should shock the conscience of most. And certainly I think it has. You know, we had over 1,000 people here in Capitol Square in Virginia protesting. This measure is just outrageous, and it was a grassroots nation effort, and I was glad to see everybody out and silent protesting, enough is enough.
To your knowledge, is this an ALEC bill? Is this something that they've thrown together?
You know what, I do not know if it's an ALEC bill or not. I would not be surprised, given the type of ALEC bills that I have seen, but I do not know if this one is.
How about the personhood bill that they're trying to ram through? Because, you know, you look, Ohio has
right.
one. There are numerous states that have them that have proposed this idea that now we're going to stop abortion by saying that conception begins at, well, when you thought about it.
Right, right. That personhood bill, I'm not sure if that's an ALEC bill, because I have certainly seen it before here at the General Assembly. It's something that has been tried before. But it also poses a threat to contraception and not just abortion. And the proponents of the personhood bill has actually sent out literature saying that contraception is indeed abortion, because they say once sperm and egg meet, you know, if you prevent implantation in the uterus, that's an abortion.
Yeah, and I've been saying for years, and, you know, I've been called a kook for the last 6 years at least, saying that the idea is not going back to Roe versus Wade. They're okay keeping, they want to go back to Griswold. They want to go back to the days where it was criminal to have birth control.
Days where it was criminal, and to make doctors criminal. And that's what's scary, that a doctor cannot even, you know, bear at risk, possibly, once the governor signs these bills, about, you know, taking appropriate medical action to care for their patient. It's serious. You know, contraception is used for some medical ailments, you know, not just to prevent pregnancy. So these bills clearly are not well thought out and pose a risk to women's health.
So wait a second. If I get this right, what you're saying is they want to put the government between me and my doctor, or my wife and her doctor? How dare they?
Are you surprised?
That's what Obamacare is supposed to do.
That's what Obamacare is supposed to do, but darn it, they're doing a very good job of it on their own right now.
You can almost laugh about it, but this stuff is deadly serious.
It's deadly serious. It's deadly serious, and there is no laugh point. It's just ironic, really.
And what kind of scares me is how easy they now say it, how far to the radical right has the Republican Party gone when they feel emboldened to say all of these really bizarre, outrageous stuff that they used to whisper to each other in their little think tanks and their secret clubs and their private clubs, all the stuff they used to whisper like little giddy schoolgirls. Now they feel emboldened to come on TV and, you know, when I was a young man, we used to use bare aspirin. The gals just put it between her knees.
Right.
You said that on national TV?
It's amazing. It's amazing. And you said it right. They're emboldened. And but you know what? I think eventually America's going to shut them down.
I sure hope so. Because, you know, I, as a man, I don't know that I would mind living in Rick Santorum's conservative world where women are second-class citizens and I have the right to tell whatever goes on.
Mm-hmm.
Problem with that is I've got two daughters. And I don't want them living in that world.
That's right, right. And I have two nieces, and I want them to live in a world where they're respected, and if they make a medical decision, that that is their decision to make, and no man telling them what to do.
So what can we do to help? Is there anything that we can
calls to legislators, and I have to say on the other side of the aisle, the Republican legislators here at the Virginia Assembly, and let them know that, you know, that these bills, that the personhood bill, the transvaginal ultrasound bill, they're unacceptable, and Virginians won't stand for it.
Do you think maybe you're going to be able to flip that legislature with this, you know, with women waking up going, hey, sorry, we got to get rid of these crazy people?
Well, I mean, they're certainly doing our work for us. I mean, this certainly is a campaign piece for the future. This is something I certainly back home, and even those who are on the pro-life side have said this is a little bit going too far. So I think it's possible that we could flip the legislature. It would take some time, but people are waking up to the extreme agenda that's being put forward.
Yeah, I mean, this is not the nation I want for my children, not at all. Charlene, I appreciate the time. Always great talking to you.
All right, thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Charlene Herring, Virginia delegate from the 46th District down there in Virginia. Quick break, back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
If an apple a day keeps the doctor away, will Apple Inc.'s public image get healthier now that it has hired an organization to monitor labor abuses in the foreign factories that make its products? Practically all of the 70 million iPhones and 30 million iPads that the computer giant sold last year were produced in Chinese factories that don't exactly shine with good working conditions. One of the largest, for example, was recently exposed for 72-hour work weeks, forced overtime, child labor, chemical poisonings, deadly explosions, and other rottenness. However, after years of refusing to allow any independent scrutiny of such facilities, Apple honchos have now thrown open the doors of its foreign suppliers, loudly announcing that an outside group called the Fair Labor Association would be free to inspect their Chinese factories. Bravo, right? Apple CEO Tim Cook positively glowed with self-satisfaction, declaring that workers everywhere had the right to safe and fair workplaces. And now he pledged FLA would be able, quote, to independently assess his company's performance. Independently? Not so fast, bucko. It turns out that FLA is notorious among anti-sweatshop groups for its coziness with corporate interests. How cozy? It is largely funded by its corporate members, the very firms being inspected. Indeed, in January, Apple became a corporate member of FLA just in time to go public with its new pledge of openness. Scott Nova is head of the Worker Rights Consortium, a legitimate anti-sweatshop group. As he dryly observed about the FLA-Apple deal, independent monitoring means you're generally independent of the companies. This is Jim Hightower saying, to find out if FLA does an honest assessment or just polishes the apple, go to workerrights.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The third agency of government, yeah. I would do away with the education, commerce. And let's see, I can't. The third one, I can't. Sorry. Oops.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, you got to wonder sometimes. And look, you know, I think we're so used to very skilled politicians who have been well-trained and well-versed that when someone gets in that situation, we're really unforgiving. Or he was just dumb. I mean, if it's your policy, shouldn't you know? I don't know. I guess I've been in a situation a couple of times where someone's asked me something and a couple of minutes later, oh, I should have said this. I get that. But when you're talking about abolishing entire departments of government, I think you should probably remember those. And I love the clip where Ron Paul's going, oh, jeez. That really makes it. Being mocked by the guy standing next to you while you're having your moment in hell. That's good. But hey, next time around, we could see Rick Perry back. He's claiming, I'll be back. You haven't heard the last of me. I'll be back. Anyway, according to analysis by the Nelson A. Rockefeller Institute of Government, since the start of the great GOP recession, the nation has lost 668,000 local and state government jobs. That is more than during any modern economic downturn. I guess we didn't have that many back when in the last Republican depression. I guess we didn't have that many government workers, 668,000 to do away with. But now here you go, gone, 668,000 jobs. We've seen massive losses to state revenues. By the end of 2011, 36 states saw their revenues lower than before the recession. So they haven't rebounded. So you're seeing cut, gut, and punish. In fact, you look at San Jose, California, who just cut 1,600 jobs in the last 4 years. So 1,600 people, what's that mean? That means smaller police forces. That means smaller public service, public safety people, fire, police, ambulance, all that stuff, public, people cleaning the streets, all less than all of that. And in fact, in San Jose, I just saw a story the other day, the police department has stopped responding to burglar alarms. That's it. Not doing it anymore. So when you, and I guess this is going to be the end put in the security system and we'll call the police for you when the alarm goes off. They've stopped it. So don't trip your alarm if you need help. And you look at what Oakland did a while ago. They stopped, any theft, we'll send somebody after the fact. Accidents, any of that stuff. We'll send somebody later. They've also seen their workers have wage cuts and pension cuts and, just some things just not happening anymore. And that's where the GOP wants to take us. That's where conservative world is. You are definitely on your own. And that's the world they're pushing, the on your own society. And, if I remember right, you go back to November of 2010, all they talked about, jobs, jobs, jobs. Have you seen anything to indicate that that's the party that you elected? All of this really just nasty division, that thing in if I were a woman and the doctor said, I've got to do this, I've got to probe you with this thing, I'd say after you. It's amazing to me that the people who said it's all about the jobs have delivered this. And I guess maybe that's a jobs bill. Maybe you're going to get a couple extra jobs out of it, people with their probes. But it's more about demoralizing and demeaning than about the jobs. But here's the thing. Here's my question. Where are all the jobs that they promised? Oh, our policies, they're cutting taxes, there's no more uncertainty, nothing's going to get done, nothing's going to happen, because they've gridlocked and delayed. Where are the jobs? 668,000 they've cost through their cut, gut, and punish. And you look at, during the Obama years, we have seen, these last 22 months, increase in private sector jobs, while they're slashing and burning of the public sector, and in the face of mass obstruction, in the face of mass opposition, in the face of poison pilling everything possible, and basically just putting their fingers in their ears and kicking and screaming like a 2-year-old. And what have we seen from them? What have they come out with? They're all the same bad policy that got us into this mess. The same failed ideas, the same failed rhetoric. About, the free market, we're freer. We just didn't go far enough. We need to continue to deregulate even more. We need to lower taxes even further. Because once it worked, we lowered taxes and it brought revenue into the government. No, it didn't. Stop that. No self-respecting economist bought that. That was a well-funded campaign by the radical right to say, oh, here, see, look, it brought more money. And no, it didn't. When Clinton raised taxes, yes, more money poured in. You know, all I see the radical right doing is demonizing. Going after the gays, going after women. And this whole thing about national debt, really? You can go down there. I'm scratching my head, because if you really, really were worried about the debt, you would support increasing the people who are buying houses with $10 million houses with cash. You know, we should be raising taxes on the folks who we've given all the money to. Two-thirds of the country agree. Republicans just don't seem to get it. But they don't care about two-thirds of the country. They care about 1% of the country, the percent that gives them all their money. I mean, and again, if you were really concerned about debt, why are we giving massive tax breaks to corporations under the guise that, oh, they're going to reinvest? Let them repatriate all that money here into the U.S. because they'll reinvest that and create jobs. No, they won't, because they haven't. We've learned that lesson. We know they won't because they never have. They're going to take that money, and they're going to say, thank you. We're going to buy back our shares, as they have done in the past. And, oh, by the way, our CEO needs a raise for bringing more revenue in by getting these tax cuts. That's what we're going to do. But, you know, they keep pounding it. You know, you got the megaphones for the mega rich, the Limbaughs, the Hannitys, the Becks, all the, on and on, who are everywhere. You could drive across this country and you could pick up Rush Limbaugh from one side to the other because he's their megaphone. You could pick up Hannity and all the rest of them because that's the megaphone. And it doesn't matter what character you put behind the microphone. They're all spewing the same message. Why? Because it's well scripted. And where does it come from? Well, it comes from the billionaire think tanks, these propaganda tanks who work tirelessly at churning out nonsense. Churning out overly simplistic messages. I mean, to me, Frank Luntz is an absolute genius. Death tax is amazing. But when you ask someone to explain what the estate tax is, every person knows death tax. Very few can explain to you what the estate tax is. You know, I once had a guy say, well, I'm going to inherit $5,000, and that government's not getting a penny of it. I'm not paying taxes on that $5,000. And I'm going, hey, ding dong. $5,000 is not putting you into the estate tax territory. But, you know, they've beaten it into our heads. And we all think, you know, hey, we're going to be that billionaire someday. So, we're going to side with them. Wake up. We're getting the screw job here. And every time you turn around, all we keep seeing is big money going in. I say we got to get the money out of politics and quickly. And I know, how are you going to do that? Well, you do that by having very strict, very open, very, very transparent laws. If I give a candidate $100, it better be written down. And you punish people for not doing it. And on the voting end, you know, this idea that, whoa, we need to have IDs. How about we go after the real fraud? The people who go out there and purposely say, oh, well, election's next week, or send out flyers deliberately with the wrong date. How about we do that first? But evidently we're not thinking that way. And this whole idea, and you know, look, the megaphones of the mega rich, they've bought into this idea that there's this mythical free enterprise system that this is just a wonder. That's what created the wealth of the country. Well, we know what created the wealth of this country. You had raw materials, you had entrepreneurs, you had workers who were all sharing in the fruits of our labors. And you had government policy that created an environment for them to work in. Not to mention we blew up all of our competition. So they were buying from us. But we had smart laws. For working people, we had laws that encouraged full employment. Now we have laws that encourage full profit. And those workers are just, well, they're a byproduct. They're a cost on the way to full profit. And you hear the radical right man, oh, we just need the free enterprise system. And look, there are things I agree with. There are capitalist principles that I buy into. But this idea of laissez-faire, this idea of unfettered free trade not working for me. And it's not working for millions and millions, if not billions, of workers on this planet. You look at Foxconn, you look at what's going on over in China. That's what they want. They want to import that here. So while we're exporting good-paying jobs, you think about Apple. Had those smartphones and had those iPads been created here, you're talking a couple hundred thousand jobs. And go back and you think about all the things that we buy that we used to produce, that somehow we've allowed the fat cats and the CEO bosses to ship overseas. It's mind-blowing. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We want the world and we want it now. We're going to take it anyhow. We want the hell with.
It's not right wing. Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Considering Earth as a whole, the year 2011 had the highest economic losses due to earthquakes on record. It also had the highest economic losses due to natural disasters overall on record.
The earthquake analysis released in early 2012 came from the Center for Disaster Management and Risk Reduction in Germany. According to their report, earthquakes and their consequences, such as tsunamis and landslides, caused damages of $365 billion. Over half of that was from the earthquake on March 11th of 2011 and the resulting tsunami in Japan.
The report said that the two countries hardest hit by earthquakes were New Zealand, with a large earthquake near Christchurch in February 2011, and Japan. The Insurance Information Institute in the U.S. and the global reinsurance firm Munich Re in Germany both issued reports calling the Japan earthquake the most costly natural disaster of any kind in history.
Globally, the Institute said, 2011 was the costliest year ever for natural disasters, and the earthquake and tsunami in Japan were a big part of that. They accounted for more than half of the total damage from natural disasters worldwide. I'm Jorge Salazar.
And I'm Deborah Bird. For more, come to earthsky.org and search for natural disasters. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. So the Obama administration's working on some new nutrition standards for foods that our kids are going to be able to purchase in schools. This is, I guess, outside of the cafeteria. Give the kids some healthy options. And I can just hear the radical right now going, see, they want to tell our kids what they can eat. The government's involved. The government's between my kids and their vending machines. The czars are taking over. But they don't seem to mind when Reagan came around and said, ketchup is a vegetable, and we're going to change the nutritional standards so that we encourage ketchup over actual vegetables. Oh, sad, sad, sad. The GOME is taking us to hell in a handbag. Anyway, to find out what's going on around the world and in Washington, D.C., I've got Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you very much.
So what's going on around the globe?
Well.
That's not a good sign.
Well, let's start with Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan.
Uh-oh.
Where protests erupted early this morning after Afghans working outside the Air Force Base told local residents that a number of copies of the Quran had been burned.
Uh-oh.
And this was shortly after dawn prayers, I believe. Not surprisingly, the local people were not happy, and they started to protest very loudly. Protesters hurled rocks, flung burning tires, and broke the windows of nearby buildings. It does employ about 5,000 local residents. About 60,000 people ended up apparently being involved in these riots. And apparently U.S. officials say the copies of the Quran were mistakenly included in a bundle of material bound for an incinerator on the base. The books were quickly removed once Afghan employees told American soldiers that burning them would be deeply sacrilegious, but it happened only after some pages of some of the books were charred. And so Afghan employees carried those remains outside the front gate as evidence of what had happened. This is not good. So,
no.
General John Allen, who is the top U.S. military officer in Afghanistan, issued a public apology to Hamid Karzai, to the people of Afghanistan, and said that there will be an investigation. So this was not intentional in any way, I assure you. I promise you.
And what would Rick Santorum say? Oh, I just burn it. Who cares? It's not the Bible. You know, they're not. They don't live in the Bible-based world.
You know, I don't know if he's been asked about that. Of course, the president would be very concerned about this for obvious reasons, which we'll get to in a minute. But I don't know whether Rick Santorum has been asked about this.
And
I was
somebody
being
should.
Sarcastic then.
I wonder if someone would do that.
They might, but there are so many topics to ask Rick Santorum about right now, aren't there?
Oh.
President and Hitler, Sony theology. I mean, where you know, it's so ripe. Where do you go?
What's amazing to me is, you know, look, you know, for people who have been paying attention to him from the beginning, he's been saying this stuff all along. This is not new. This is his shtick. But now he's rising in the polls, and I think folks are paying attention, which is why it's not surprising to me that one of the polls I saw, you know, in 1 week, support from women dropped from 42 to 34%. I'm surprised it's still that high.
Well, a lot of people aren't paying attention to the campaign yet. But I think, you know, the thing is you can say things when you're at 2% in the polls that you can't say when you're at 38% in the polls, and that's where he is now.
Yep.
And 36, 38, something like that.
You know, what scares me is my Tea Party dentist I talked to yesterday. He's going,
Tea Party dentist?
Yeah, I have a dentist who's a Tea Party guy.
And
it tells you how dumb I am. I argue with him while he's cleaning my teeth. Probably, I'm not the brightest guy on the planet, probably. But here's the thing. He goes, well, I bet you want to have Rick Santorum as the Republican nominee. And I'm going, I don't know, because, you know, I remember 1980. Carter wanted Reagan, who was the radical, the extremist at the time, and they were able to manufacture something to get him elected. I can't imagine this country with a President Santorum.
Well, that's what's so interesting, isn't it?
No.
It could happen. I mean, things happen in life.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that scare me. Yeah, because at the end of it, I still have two daughters. And the world that he envisions is completely different than the world I want for them.
Well, look, if they get married and have babies, they should be all right.
You know,
if they get married and have babies. If they don't, well, then that's, you know, then obviously they were not living up to their full potential as women.
Yeah, that's not the world I want them living in.
I understand that.
And, you know, I don't want them practicing poorly the rhythm method like both Romney and Santorum. What, Santorum's got 8 kids and Romney's got 5?
Yeah.
Too many. Too many. Okay, what else is going on?
Well, staying overseas, Iran today was a bit belligerent, or bellicose, whichever you prefer, said that it would take preemptive action against perceived enemies if it feels its national interests were threatened. Mohammed Hejazi, who is the Deputy Armed Forces head, said today, our strategy now is that if we feel our enemies want to endanger Iran's national interests and want to decide to do that, we will act without waiting for their actions.
Well, I mean, you know, we've got preemptive policies of the past that may turn around and bite us here.
Well, it's very unfortunate. It's very unfortunate. This is happening at the same time as there is an IAEA team, a UN nuclear inspector team, in the country, the second time in about 3 weeks, The idea was that they would go to some sort of disputed nuclear facilities that they didn't get to go to last time. Tehran said they're not going to those nuclear facilities.
So they're basically, they're trying to egg something on.
Yeah.
Jeez. Yeah, just what we need. Insanity. Just nuts. The Supreme Court has a some new information, new hearing.
Yeah, Supreme Court's doing a couple of interesting things, actually. One thing that it may be trying to do is to avoid, now maybe this is all talk, but this is Washington and that's what we do is we talk. They may be trying to avoid making a ruling on the health care case until 2014. You see, the Anti-Injunction Act is an old law that says courts can't halt a tax that hasn't yet been collected. And under the Affordable Care Act, it won't be collected until 2014.
Right.
So, basically, under that, you could say, well, then this lawsuit doesn't stand up yet. So, which is interesting, because both the Obama administration and the plaintiffs said, no, the AIA doesn't apply, we want to go forward. But the Supreme Court said today, you know, maybe it does. And so what we're going to do is we're appointing two lawyers to argue that it does,
nice,
to go up against your lawyers. This is a scream. And they also decided today that when next month's oral arguments happen, they're not going to be 5.5 hours, they're going to be 6 hours, and the extra half hour will be to discuss the application of the Anti-Injunction Act. So it's a full hour and a half to discuss whether the court has the authority to rule on the health law this year. Could it be that Chief Justice Roberts does not want to be in the middle of making a decision in an election campaign?
Oh, absolutely. And I was surprised they took it. I got to be honest. I thought from the beginning that's what their argument was going to be, because you have to have somebody who has to have standing. And, you know, no one's really been hurt by it yet, or so-called hurt by it, by having to pay the tax. And it seems logical to me, but I think you're right. You know, this is them wanting to get out from under the political microscope.
The other thing they decided today was to hear a major case on affirmative action in higher education. This is about a case, a 5-4 decision that they made in 2003. They decided that public colleges and universities could not use a point system to boost minority enrollment, but that they could take race into account in a vaguer way to ensure academic diversity. And the decision was written by Sandra Day O'Connor, and she said the accommodation was meant to last 25 years.
Yeah, was that, I don't remember that being the language, was it?
No, she wrote that and said that the accommodation was meant to last 25 years, and apparently it's lasted 9, so because they're going to do it all over again, because they are going to hear this case. Of course, they've got a different court. They've got Samuel Alito, who has voted with the conservative justices in decisions hostile to the use of racial classifications by the government. Also, Anthony Kennedy, who's the swing vote, has never voted to uphold an affirmative action program.
Oh, so this is a slam dunk. All right, well, kiss that goodbye.
And Justice Elena Kagan has disqualified herself from hearing the case.
Because she was... Was she in
worked on it, presumably, as a Solicitor General, we assume. We don't know, but that's what we assume. So that's what I'm thinking.
Interesting. And lastly, you know, our most Christianist president in the whole... possible president in the whole world?
Well, it depends who you ask, but if you ask Evangelist Franklin Graham, it's probably not going to be President Obama.
No, I wouldn't think so.
Who was on
he's a Muslim. He's a Muslim.
Well, he could be. Definitely, could not say he's definitely not. Under Sharia law, Islam sees him as a son of Islam. Because his father was a Muslim, his grandfather was a Muslim. That's just the way it works. That's just the way they see it.
Must have missed that one.
Most people in Islam say, you know, that is just rubbish. You have to affirmatively make a decision.
Okay. And?
He obviously hasn't. He just spoke at the National Prayer Breakfast, and he gave an intense personal confession of his deep Christian faith.
Yeah, but I don't believe him.
No, of course, because it was a fake out.
So who is the most Christianist president of all time?
Well, that was my question. Well, we don't know, but in this election cycle, according to Franklin Graham, that would be Rick Santorum.
Okay, so now we know.
Yeah.
All right, well, okay. You know what? I'll even concede that one. If he becomes president, he will be the super Christian president.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wonder if all the people who were against Kennedy because Kennedy was Catholic, I wonder what they would think of Santorum.
Good question.
Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, Victoria, great talking with you. I appreciate the update from the belly of the beast. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Working class majority. Rick Smith.
For many, the 8-hour day is the standard, but it wasn't always this way. The original American workday was from sunup to sundown, following the demands of an agricultural workday. Over time, the nation became more industrialized and workers moved from individually owned, self-sufficient farms to factories, taking workers from their homes and families. Factory owners demanded the agricultural sunup to sundown workday, forcing workers to toil long hours in grueling conditions. Workers began to collectively organize in pursuit of more time for family, education, and recreation. The cry of 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for what we will grew louder. For a century, the 8-hour day was viewed as the holy grail of the labor movement, and for this hallowed vision, workers sacrificed, often with their blood and their lives. The first strike for shorter hours occurred in May of 1791 in the city of Philadelphia, where carpenters protested a day's wages, paying the same in January as was paid for a longer day in July. Chicago in 1886 was home to one of the largest showings of solidarity. Some 80,000 workers turned out to support the 8-hour cause. It was in Chicago's Haymarket Square that a terrorist bomb and the blazing guns of company-paid police cost policemen and numerous workers their lives and their blood. As a result of the Haymarket tragedy, 8 innocent men were tried and convicted for a crime they did not commit. 4 of the men were hung. The Haymarket Square tragedy was but one of many battles in which working men, women, and children shed blood, tears, and flesh in the pursuit of 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for what we will. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Month was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website, or if you've got a smartphone, you can get the Stitcher app and take the program on the go. Questions, comments, something on your mind, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. So, Gingrich was on Fake News on Fox with Chris Wallace over the weekend. I guess it was on Sunday. And he's talking about gas prices. He's going to get going after the president because, you know, the president hasn't done enough for gas prices. And, you know, if I were president, I don't understand why we can't have a stable price around $2 or $2.50 per gallon. And, you know, it kind of makes you go, you know, the manipulators, the speculators, the people who are driving this thing up, can't we do something about them? What does Gingrich say about them? Well, nothing. He says, you can't guarantee any, you know, prices, but, you know, I would do more. I would do more than he's done. And his rationale? I love this. You can't put a gun rack in a vault. That's his whole, and I guess, you know, there are people out there, who that plays for. And now he's talking to the people in Georgia because Georgia has the most, delegates, you know, for the convention, that are, you know, between now and Super Tuesday, and he's going to try and sway some of them. But I loved his statement. He said, there's no reason not to believe that we could stabilize with American production by drowning demand in supply the old-fashioned free market way. And I started thinking about this, you know, the old-fashioned way, you know, the supply and demand. Demand has gone down. We are actually, and amazingly so, we are using much less gasoline than we did last year, and last year you used less than you did the year before. So demand is going down, but prices keep going up. So, you know, supply and demand means, you know, you have a shortage, which causes an increase in price. I don't see there being a shortage. We have a bunch of it. I've never pulled up to a gas pump where they go, sorry, out of gas. So we don't have a shortage. What we've got is we've got a system that's set up. We put everything into the international market, which is basically controlled by a cartel, a gang, a mob, whatever you want to call, that set these prices and hold us hostage. This idea that we're going to drill, baby, drill, nobody has explained to me yet. And there have been amendments offered that say that, okay, if we drill, baby, drill, that stuff stays here. No, that's not reality. In fact, most of what comes out of Alaska doesn't even come to the U.S. The Keystone XL pipeline that they wanted to run through the U.S. to get down to Texas, nobody said that that was going to benefit us. You know, as I said, you know, you want to run it to Chicago, I'm okay with it. Run it into Chicago, refine it there, and ship it out to all the 48 states. Give it to all of us. Alaska's got its own. It doesn't need ours. Hawaii, I guess we could boat some over. But the reality is look, folks, they've got us. They've got a monopoly. You want to drive your car? You want to get to work? You got really one way. Because most cities have horrible public transportation. Where I live to where I work, there's no way I can use public transportation. And that's the way they want to keep it. And I just find it absolutely amazing that you've got these Santorum, you know, well, we just need to drill more. Gingrich, we need to drill, baby, drill. Romney, same thing. When the reality is we need alternative energy solutions. We need to get off of the juice. And I guess the question I have is when it hits $5 a gallon, which, you know, some people are saying that it may, who's going to be to blame? Will Obama be the guy who's blamed? I mean, after all, he is the president who's tried to get us off the juice. He is the guy who's been out there pushing alternative energy. He's the guy who put his presidency on the line for solar and wind, and we've given a boatload of loan guarantees to companies to try and produce some. Done a whole lot more than the bushwhacker did. And you look at the fact that, you know, there's some experts who are claiming peak oil's just around the corner. What does that mean? Does that mean no more drill, baby, drill? What happens if you drill and nothing comes out? Oh, we'll just use the really nasty stuff. It's just amazing. But if you hear the righties talk about the story of this country, man, it's wonderful. We could just drill, drill, drill. I don't know. You know, sometimes you just shake your head at the sheer ignorance. You want to hear something else really, really fairly, really ignorant? Got a press release from the people at Americans for Prosperity Foundation, the nation's largest advocate for economic freedom. Are you kidding me? Anyway, they have written, here's their press release. They released a bold new plan. They are going to reform the nation's troubled Social Security program. That's right. Bold, new vision, forward thinking. They want to give workers the freedom to keep the payroll tax contributions and put it into private accounts. Bold? No. New? Definitely not. Just a new press release. This is over and over and over what the Republican machine does. They just repackage stuff. I mean, all of the things that we're talking, nothing's new. They're just trying to figure out a new way to screw us. And the press release goes into saying that, you know, Social Security consumes 20% of the entire federal budget. And the so-called trust fund will be completely bankrupt in 2036. Understand, the trust fund, originally, the idea of the trust fund was to pay for the baby boomers. The idea was is the baby boomers would be the first generation to pay for the, to prepay for their Social Security, because they were such a large, demographically, they were such a large group that we knew, and they were smart in doing it. They knew that they were going to have to do something for the future, because, you know, when these people retire and go to get Social Security, the workforce is never going to be able to pay for them. So they raised taxes, the largest tax increase in the history of civilization, pretty much. The Reagan administration, the people who never raised your taxes and lowered it on the rich people, and quite substantially, you know, from 70 down to 50, down to 28, which is how we built a very prosperous, a very, very prosperous billionaire class. You people at the bottom, screw you, you're on your own. Now, this is the on your own society. So we built this box, this trust fund idea, that the pig going through the python, which was the analogy that they used. The baby boomers were like a pig going through the python. That they were so large that we had to pre-fund it. So they raised taxes way up, 13.6, if I remember right. So they raised it way up. They were going to take all this money. They were going to put it in a big pot. And when they needed it, they were going to dole it out. And at the end, it would go bankrupt. The idea of the trust fund was that at the end of the baby boomers, it would end as well. And we would return to a pay-as-you-go system. Because, you know, I think they understood at the beginning, if we have a big pot of cash sitting around, someone's going to steal it. And I think that's the reason the Reagan administration started it, so they could steal it. Because they needed to cover the huge, massive deficits of that time frame. Because understand, they were blowing money like drunken sailors on a leave they didn't get. They were out there working. What? There's a defense project? Needs billions? Make it trillions. And they depleted a good portion of the trust fund. And if you remember Alan Simpson, the Republican who was on the Wyoming senator who was on the Cat Food Commission, said, you know, and I forget who the guy was, but he told him, well, money's all gone. We spent it. We spent it on roads and bridges and all this other stuff. And the guy said, in two wars? And, well, Alan didn't want to go there, but he admitted, you know, we had money in the trust fund. We blew it. And when Bush was running around with the filing cabinet saying, it's IOUs. Filing cabinets for IOUs. Yeah, that's IOUs backed by the full faith and credit of the federal government. We borrowed money from ourselves that we have to pay back. They don't want to pay it back. So they want to cut, gut, and punish. They want to kick granny to the curb and steal Social Security. And they've done a nice job of convincing the younger generation, people younger than me, of, and I love, you know, the George, whatever, Prescott Bush's little statement is, I'll see a UFO before I see a Social Security check. That's the mean that the business, that the wealth class is thrown out at us. Oh, you don't need this safety net. You don't need it. You can have your own account so we can steal from you individually. Understand what they're telling you. We're going to steal from you individually because the Supreme Court's already said you can't do a class action suit. So good luck. You're ours. Now, like George Carlin said, it's a big club. And you and I are not in the big club. Wake up, America. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com, best place to go. If you've got a smartphone, don't forget Stitcher. You can take the program on the go. And if you've got any questions, comments, something I said ticked you off, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally, especially the crazy ones. I love the crazy, especially the ones. I got one not too long ago. Guy wished me nothing but ill health. I always love those. Thank you. I appreciate the, it's always nice to know somebody's thinking about me. Anyway, have a great night, and we will see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The